Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack.
The Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. And Jalene Jordan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Peter.
We were off last week.
We were. Good to be back.
And as we always say, we're probably the only people that don't like to get the night off.
Right. Exactly. Right. Too much to talk about.
Yeah. When we were doing 5 days a week, I got a day off. It didn't bother me. But when we're doing one show a week, yeah, I missed it. But I got, and I don't want to talk a lot about this because it ain't no big deal, but I got sliced and diced.
Yeah.
Had a little hernia repair surgery. It's all done, all recovered, so no need to wish. I don't know that any of you would, but probably a few out there are wishing for complications, but there weren't any, so.
Really, Peter, you think?
It's all over.
And you're like brand new.
Yeah. I got one email from someone that said, "Dear sir," this is from last week, "Peter Werby is off. He has too much to do. He's dancing the jerk with Jesus." The jerk was some 60s dance?
Yeah, I know the jerk. I could probably do it right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's weird.
I'll spare you.
Weird email.
Yeah, that is weird.
I'm losing stuff already.
Wow.
How the hell?
We're 1 minute into the show, Peter.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you the basics.
Okay.
This is a talk show, phone-in talk show for those of you just joining us for the first time. And our phone number, as Mr. Announcer told you, is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
That gets you on the air. And we're always open line in the sense, if you're new to talk shows at all, that you can bring up anything at any time. I suppose somewhat within reason. And Al Slayer is manning the phone. So he'll,
yes.
I guess, there's some filtering process.
There's a little bit.
Yeah, for the bashful or if our lines are filled. Call talk yes, that's our email. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And have you done anything with our MySpace page?
I need to do that.
Okay, well,
I moved this past week.
You did.
I moved from one whole house to a whole other house, and you know.
You live a couple blocks from us now.
I do. That's one of the, you know, they say the biggies in life, you know, death, divorce, moving, and I can attest to that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, well. There goes the neighborhood.
Values shooting up as we speak.
Well, I sent out an email to my listener list. And you can go to, if you want to go to that calltalkyes@yahoo.com and get on my email list. Once in a while, I send out emails. They're never real exciting, but sometimes you.
Informative.
They're informative. Yeah, you find out that I was having a little surgery. But a listener named Al wrote in. And he says, "I hope you're feeling well and are on the fast track to a total recovery after your hernia surgery." He says, "I don't have health insurance, self-employed, live a healthy lifestyle and take my chances. I developed a hernia several years ago and have been living with it while assemble information and try to plan a way to deal with it."
Oh, no.
This is just criminal.
It really is.
I mean, the real criminals in this society, Bush and the rest of these guys, spending, what is it up to now, like $2.5 trillion, the war in Iraq and all this is going to cost us, and they're just asking for another $200 billion. And here's a hardworking man that's self-employed and has to live with a hernia. Now, mine wasn't even painful. I mean, I just felt a little bulge, and I went, whoa, and they said, yeah. And they said, okay. Yeah. Like, but there are people that, because they don't have health insurance, that they have to just go
live with it. Live in pain.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they can be dangerous. Most people think that they're just uncomfortable. But they have this thing called strangulation, where you can actually, the little bit of your intestine gets closed off and dies, and you can die.
Gee whiz.
Anyway, let's see. He says he asked to assemble information, try to plan a way to deal with it. The last time I had surgery was for a torn knee cartilage, and it was much more invasive procedure back then. Took about a month to heal. I can't afford to be without work for that long, so I'm trying to get an idea about current surgical procedures for hernia and how long the total recuperation takes. I do heavy lifting.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, now, again, this is horrible. It's 6 weeks minimum before you can do, I have to go see the surgeon this Friday. And in the meantime, I'm not playing handball. I was even kind of wary doing Tai Chi, which is pretty, soft stuff. And, I had to have a friend of ours bring in this big plant from off of our patio today. I didn't want to pick that up even.
Well, yeah. It's best to play it safe. And I'm sure you, being the active man you are going completely stir crazy.
Yeah, I am. I have been doing so much internet stuff and reading, though, as well. A lot of reading and internet and DVDs. So this is what you have, folks, when you don't have a national health program, a single-payer health program that takes the L's of the world and said, you're a valued member of our society, and we don't want you suffering. We don't want to spend all our money on these rat holes of war and preparation for war and Star Wars and the rest of this insane social and economic program that Bushco, this racket posing as a government, has thrust upon us. I mean, I don't even know if we could have a national health program as long as we have this this war budget that is so insane.
Yeah, money drain.
Money drain. Money drain indeed. Sort of on the just on the same subject of health, let's see, Hardee's, that fast food place?
Yeah.
They have something now called the Country Breakfast Burrito.
Oh, yeah. Well, the other biggie, McDonald's, has had a breakfast burrito for a long time.
How about this? So it's two egg omelets filled with bacon, sausage, diced ham, cheddar cheese, hash browns, and sausage gravy, all wrapped in a flour tortilla. The burrito contains 920 calories and 60 grams of fat.
Not maybe the best way to start your day.
No. Can't these people be, like, arrested for attempted murder?
How many meats do you need in one dish?
Yeah.
In one burrito.
In 2003, this chain introduced a line of big sandwiches, including the Monster Thick Burger, a 1,420-calorie sandwich made up of two one-third-pound slabs of beef, four strips of bacon, three slices of cheese and mayonnaise on a buttered bun.
Okay. Call that heart attack on a plate.
Yeah. You might want to go for the chicken salad. That always, kind of healthy.
Yeah.
Topped with onion rings and crispy chicken. 1,100 calories, 83 grams of fat.
Wow. Fast Food Nation obviously did nothing.
Yeah. Has anybody got any reason why we shouldn't have a national health program? I mean, I can't even imagine what the arguments are now against it. What does Bush say? Well, anybody can get it. They just go to the emergency room.
Yeah. Okay, sit there and bleed to death before you get in there, and then...
Well, spoken like a rich kid who never had to worry about health care at all.
Are you talking about you or me? Because I worry about it.
Do you? Well, you don't have health insurance?
No, not right now. Working on it, though. I am working on it.
Well, you can always go to the emergency room.
Right. Thank you, GW.
I'm kind of old school. So when these teams, particularly in baseball, that I can't tell whether they're football or basketball or baseball, like the Colorado Rockies.
Yeah.
I didn't have any idea the Boston Red Sox, the venerable Boston Red Sox are playing a basketball team. And then I realized it's got to be a baseball team, right?
Sports not your strength. Yeah, playing them, maybe.
Yeah, so I like to play them. And but well, if it was like Boston, I don't know, the Chicago Cubs or something like that.
Well, your family in Boston, so maybe doesn't it make you. So what you're saying is you're paying attention to the World Series for some reason?
Well, the only reason I'm paying attention to it is I find out about the Rockies there are these born again nuts.
The players?
The players. They think Jesus is on their side.
Okay, so the owner is a born-again nut? Is this what's going on? Okay.
Yeah. Last year, the Rockies went public with the news that the organization was looking for players with character. And according to the team management, character means players who have chosen Jesus as their personal Lord and manager.
This guy has a completely different idea of character than I do.
Yeah.
And you.
You know, during the 19th century, a lot of people in the labor movement, when they would be trying to organize a strike in the coal fields or in industrial situations, the railroads, and then these preachers would come along, and they called them the God pests.
Like really?
P-E-S-T-S.
Ah.
Like the God pests.
Huh.
Like they just pester you. Like all the religious people we know, they don't pester you about the Lord and all that stuff. They just do their thing, right?
Right, do their thing. Except for the women who knock on my door.
Well, they're pests.
And want to talk, yeah.
I know, they're the
God
pests.
I tell them, I will look at them straight in the eye and say, I'm telling you now, there is no chance you are ever going to get me to come over to your religion. So will you please not come back? And they still come back.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, if you want to call right now, there's open lines, 313-298-WRIF. Well, the Rockies chairman and CEO, Charlie Monfort, said, I think character-wise, we're stronger than anyone in baseball, Christians. And what they've endured, and some of the strongest people in baseball. I believe God sends signs, and we're seeing those. And we are, because Boston is up 3-0, and in the 7th inning, Boston is in the 4th game. It's going to be another sweep, another boring World Series.
Where is God for this guy right now?
Well, someone was telling me about it. They heard a little skit on radio, is that St. Peter runs up to God and starts saying, our team, the Colorado Rockies, they're losing. And God says, Pete, I got some other things on my plate, like the fires in
California.
I mean, actually, the arrogance of these people, that they think that somehow, listen to this, that they're getting a sign from God about their silly-ass baseball team.
Yeah, and you know, we've heard that before. Remember, God told George W. Bush to go over to Iraq.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Wait a minute, what has happened here? Where all of a sudden the page from there, even if you want to watch this, RockyMountainNews.com, and then they have the unless it's all over. Let me see here. Let me get my little doodad here.
Most people wouldn't expect us to talk about sports, but when it's tied to something like this.
Uh-oh. The Rockies just hit a homer.
Oh, God!
Brad
God
Hoff.
Spoke.
God spoke. Maybe I shouldn't talk about a no hitter. Isn't that kind of the?
Yes, that's a thing.
All right.
That is.
So we won't do that. Let's
okay.
see. What else? Is there anything else on? Oh, this is just more baseball stuff. Now all of a sudden they had the games. They have an unmoderated chat during World Series Game 4 on the RockyMountainNews.com. So I went in there and I started saying, well, Jesus just left Denver.
Did you get any good responses?
No one picked up on it. They were talking about something that didn't even have to do with baseball. So that's why I'm rooting for the Red Sox. If they're Jesus's team, I mean, do you think that Jesus would have anything to do with a baseball
No.
Or a soul singer, a rapper. I mean, all these things. First of all, if I want to thank Jesus. I mean, Jesus really? Oh, man, don't even get me started.
Yeah, I know.
Don't
That's always probably my least favorite part of those shows, those award shows.
Yeah. A lot of anti-war activity all through the United States. There were 11 planned nationwide to have regional anti-war demonstrations planned by United for Peace and Justice. You can go to unitedforpeace.org. And turned out, though, that hundreds of cities had them, including a number of them here. There was one in Detroit. Anybody have any reports on any of those? There was a peace train went from Detroit to Chicago.
Chicago, yeah.
I would have gone, but having just had that little bit of surgery, I didn't want to walk 2.5 miles. And
not a good idea.
And I didn't want to, you know, the Chicago cops get a little nutty sometimes, you know.
Chicago, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I couldn't run. But it seemed that all the figures were underestimated. Gee, what a surprise. Right?
Every time.
Yeah. So here's one from the Chicago Tribune about it. Lenore Lee was among the thousands rallying in Chicago on Saturday to protest the war in Iraq. Shows our solidarity, makes me love this country even more. She says it's the most powerful expression of power to the people. I'll go for that.
You know what? If there's one thing the media is consistent about, it is the fact that they always underreport those numbers.
Sure.
They're completely consistent in that.
Yeah. Police estimated about 5,000 people attended the event. Now, why at least? So, I mean, anything is news. I mean, that these are the officials that are charged with supervising all of this, make sure everything goes according, not attacking the demonstrators like they often do, usually unprovoked, but rather they should guard it. They should make sure that the First Amendment rights of everyone, a free speech and the right to assemble for redress of grievances, of which we have many, seen to. But crowd estimates really isn't their thing, and they always underestimate. Very frequently, they're right wing, and they have a vested interest in
making it sound small.
Yeah, yeah. So they say 5,000. So I'm going to go 10,000 at least. Anybody listening, go to that 313-298-WRIF. But or any of the other ones around, small ones out in the suburbs of Detroit. There was, I think, a big march in Detroit itself. During the rally in Union Park, where about 2,000 protesters assembled, quickly diving there, they had three U.S. Congressmen, Danny Davis, Luis Gutierrez, and Jan Schakowsky. And let's see, police arrested three protesters who were charged with disobeying an officer. Schakowsky, Representative Schakowsky, called for cutting off funding for the war and immediate decrease in the number of American troops stationed in Iraq. How radical, except that almost everybody in America agrees with that, except for these whacked out. Most of the Republicans even agree with this. But now here. After turning on Jackson Boulevard in Chicago, protesters marched into the Loop and descended on Federal Plaza, where they were met by more than 20 counter-protesters.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you think that's an accurate number?
Well, you know
what? It was probably 50.
There is why are they counter-protesters? They don't say anything. I'm looking at a photograph of them. And they have American flags, and they say Chicago loves and appreciates our soldiers. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
We do too.
Yeah. Except here's one of their signs too. You keep fighting there. We've got your back here.
Ooh. Yeah. Why don't you go over there?
Here's what they're doing for the troops. Most of the Americans, and in an active sense, the anti-war movement wants to take all of our soldiers out of harm's way. They tell them, you keep fighting there. They're encouraging this continuing death and destruction and this absolute waste of our tax money on this rat hole of Bush's wars. We've got your back here.
Yeah, yeah. Some support. Nice support.
We've got your back here. Oh.
So twisted.
Twisted. Twistoids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a mission accomplished.
Yes.
I was just driving here, and there it was, gasoline, $3 a gallon. Because you remember, when Clinton ended his presidency on January 20th, 2001, a day that will live in infamy,
yes.
Oil was $20 a barrel. Right now, it's $90
Whoa.
A barrel. And and think about it. All those guys in the Bush administration and Bushco, they're in what? Sugar. What industry are they in?
Wait, oil.
Oil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Man, you don't think there's a connection.
I don't know. Are we connecting the dots again?
Let me see. It was $20.
Yeah.
It was $20 a gallon when Clinton was in.
Right.
And now the oil men take over, and it becomes 90. And this article in CNN Money, go to CNNMoney.com, says here comes $100 a barrel oil and $3 gas. Well, hello, it's already $3 a gallon. With crude setting new highs every day, experts say there's no way motorists won't see a spike at the pump. We're going to see, says Stephen Schork, president of the industry newsletter, The Schork Report. At this rate, we're going to see $4 a gallon.
Oh.
Because they've realized, remember I was talking about how they bump it up a little, and then they drop it, and then they bump it up.
Yes.
And so it was over. Remember, what was it, like 3.25?
It was up there, right?
Yeah, so it's down to like 2.79. We're going,
I think it's a bargain. Yeah.
So now they're going to try it on us again. And of course, these nutballs like Cheney, he's like fanning the flames of war with Iran, which drives the price up.
Yeah.
Now, he can't help but know this. He cannot help but know, since most of the people in the world and most of the people in the United States know that this guy is a total warmongering whack job.
Yes.
And controls, we haven't used this phrase in a long time. He has his hand up the back of the sock puppet, Bush.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That this is going to drive the price of oil up.
Yeah. And, you know, he's doing it on purpose. And he's got to feed his friends.
Yeah. And he's still getting money from Halliburton. Yeah. He still gets it all.
Yep.
He still gets it all.
And people just sit back and take it.
Well, yeah. Well, here's part of the problem. We've done everything under the sun. First and foremost, we defeated Bush in 2000. Actually, we defeated Bush in 2004 as well. It's a little more complicated. But then, definitively, we said no to the Bush crimes and lies in 2006. And we've marched. We've elected a Democratic Congress. And these guys just keep going along like they haven't heard the word. That they've been rejected. That they have been repudiated everything under the sun, and that's why there's starting to be, particularly among activists, I mean, if all the people are coming to you and say, well, do you support Bush? You go, no. Most everyone goes, no, I don't. Mm-hmm. Right, there's no problem there. But the people that have been active for the last 7 years, they're starting to get a real burnout.
Yeah.
And I know people who you know as well, that they're just getting exhausted.
Right, yeah. Well, I think it's been that way for a lot of activists like me. Remember, a few years ago, I was done, you know? I was burnt out.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I didn't stop, but I just actually just went further into throwing myself into my activism. So
yeah,
it kind of helped.
Well, here we go. The Red Sox now beating the Bornagains 4-1.
Okay, good.
4-1.
Keep us posted, Peter.
Jesus just left Denver.
He's doing what was the dance? The jerk?
The jerk.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here, soft spot for the South Bronx. Did I send you that one?
No.
Yeah. Well, so the price is going up. We're paying more and more. And, of course, who the big operators that are making all the money off of it, particularly ExxonMobil and companies like that. But there's one company where Jolene and I, many of you, buy your gasoline, is at CITGO.
Right.
CITGO is a distributor in the United States for the Venezuelan National Petroleum Company. And rather than all the profits going to their...
Oh, I did see this one.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Rather than going back to just stockholders, which they don't have, go to the poor of Venezuela and also the poor of the United States. And here's an article from the New York Times. It says, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, began his love affair with the Bronx during a visit in 2005. Since then, he and his socialist government have funneled millions of dollars of aid to the South Bronx. I hate those socialists. Because they funnel millions of dollars of aid to the South
Poor
Bronx.
Poor people.
Home to New York's poorest congressional district through CITGO Petroleum, the American subsidiary of Venezuela's state-owned oil company. It is an unlikely flow of largesse from an oil-rich South American country where much of the population lives in poverty to one of the neediest pockets in the seat of American capitalism. CITGO started its outreach in 2005 with a 40% discount on heating oil for poor households and expanded it in August to finance social and economic development. The company is committed to donating $3.6 million over the next 3 years to 9 Bronx initiatives that would use the money to create jobs, foster community empowerment, and clean up the urban environment. I'm just looking at the ball score, too. The program has made Mr. Chavez the talk of the South Bronx. Patrice White McGlees, an unemployment counselor, saved $160 to $300 a month during the past 2 winters through the discounted oil program, and she says she knows why Mr. Chavez's actions have rankled. She says it's a sore point because it took what most people would consider a third-world country to help the U.S., which is kind of a slap in our face because we're supposed to be one of the superpowers.
Yeah.
Why can't we help our own? Hello? Chavez haters?
Yeah.
You know,
America
number one advocators.
I'd like to know how the Chavez haters can twist this one.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's in here, actually. Some people in Caracas, the Venezuelan capital, have the same question for their own government, said Leopoldo Lopez, mayor of the downtown district of Chicao and a leader of the Venezuelan opposition, the people opposed in Venezuela, because there's an active opposition there. It's not a a dictatorship. He asked, why is the government giving away money to the richest city in the world? He says that Chavez should first tend to the needs of Venezuelans who lack shelter, sewage, and drinking water. Now, I don't want to get in that debate. I mean, there is something to say about that. I've been in Caracas, and the poverty there is just absolutely amazing. A lot of Chavez's programs are beginning to work at that, to provide medical care and these cooperatives and schools. But the poverty is so bad from the way they were looted for so long.
Yeah, so how can he fix it overnight?
Yeah, I don't know that he can, but there are people that are saying, hey, why should we give anything to the United States when our people are so poor in Venezuela? And, you know, there's some logic to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a wonderful gesture. I mean, Chavez is doing this all around the South America and the Caribbean basin, giving the poor discounted oil prices and what have you. But the question that is asked by this recipient says, we're supposed to be one of the superpowers. Why can't we help our own? Well, the question really should be is, why don't we help our own? Why don't we help our own? Why are there people like Al who can't get a hernia operation? Why are there people like Patrice White McLeese and so many other people in the South Bronx and in Detroit and probably in your neighborhood, too, that that can't have a secure economics situation where they're not always worried or denying themselves or their kids or what have you? Or Bush, you know, denying millions of poor kids medical care. Let's see, there's a little bit more in here. The program that Chavez has set up has delivered 100 million gallons to 1.2 million people from Alaska to Vermont. Citgo said it expected to supply 110 million gallons this winter.
Wow.
The Citgo donations are a tiny percentage of its annual budget. Well, there's one of the answers, okay? And if it shames the United States, if it makes us look, why is the richest country in the world needed to be subsidized by essentially a country filled with poor people, that's really good. Citgo does not disclose its financial statements because it's not a publicly traded company. Citgo, which sold 25.1 billion gallons of petroleum products last year, estimates that last winter's oil program costed $80 million. That's about the same as ExxonMobil, the largest publicly traded oil company with roughly 10 times the revenue of Citgo.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the ambassador to the United States from Venezuela. So we're not trying to impose or to intervene in politics here. United States petroleum officials are not happy, however, with Citgo's program.
Of course they're not, because they can't do the same thing, or they won't.
Oh, they won't.
They can.
Because,
they won't.
As we've said so many times before, the ExxonMobil ex-CEO has got a $44 million retirement package.
Ah.
Why couldn't they give him Why couldn't they give him a $4 million and spend $40 million on that? Larry Goldstein, president of the Energy Policy Research Foundation, an industry-supported analysis group in Washington, said, it's designed to embarrass us. Well, hello, it's not designed to help poor people.
It just seems so like high school, junior high.
Yeah. Well, let's say it is designed to embarrass, quote, us. Why are we in the position where we can be embarrassed?
Right.
Is the question.
Yeah,
that's
take a look at the root of things.
Hey, Larry, get some of the fat cat rich people that you represent to take over the program. Say, hey, we don't need Hugo Chavez giving our people money besides and discounted oil. They need it in Venezuela. We're going to step in and make up the difference. In fact, if Chavez can have a program to help the poor from Alaska to Vermont to the South Bronx, well, we can do it all the better in the United States, because here's what ExxonMobil and Gulf and Shell and the rest of them, which aren't all American companies, and we're going to do it that much better, but all they do is whine.
Yeah, and cash in.
And cash in. All right, we're going to take a break. I got some other things to talk about. You call us up, Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Or call TalkYes at Yahoo.com.
What do you got there?
The pictures,
the podcast,
the blog,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else. Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before the commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening
listening, WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joining me, Jalene Jordan. You can join us, 313-298-WRIF, and, boy, a lot of emails. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. I know you're going to be at this concert, Jalene. David Rovix is going to be in town this Saturday, November 3rd, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Because I thought maybe you were thinking, do you have a gig to do?
I have the night off.
You have the night off. All right. David Rovix, an amazing singer, songwriter, activist, and he has been called the Phil Oaks, O-C-H-S. For those of you who say, Phil Oaks, who the hell is that?
Check him out.
Check him out. Google this man. It's going to be at AJ's Cafe, which is on West 9 Mile Road, just west of Woodward. You go to my
Ferndale.
In Ferndale. Fabulous Ferndale. Yeah. Which is having an extraordinarily interesting race for mayor. There's a man, I can't remember his first name now, named Covey. Actually, I know.
I've seen the sign.
Yeah, yeah. Now, he is someone who wants an all-inclusive, diverse Ferndale, and he's running against this guy who puts Ann Coulter on his website.
Okay, so it's Ferndale real, cannot have this.
Yeah, it's a real left-right.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you want to see the information about David Rovix coming to Ferndale next Saturday, November 3rd, you go to my website and go to the calendar, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, or go to David Rovix, R-O-V-I-C-S. Actually, I would suggest the latter. Go to both. Go to both. All right, now we're even taking a phone call, Angeline. This is kind of a surprise for you.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice surprises.
All right, here is the surprise. It's Billy Sunshine from Santa Cruz, California. Billy!
Jalene!
Billy!
Peter's making you move near him, huh?
Yeah, we Peter and I are overmerged. Yeah. It's okay.
Hey, guys. How about this country of ours?
Oh. Which part? Where do we start?
Where do we start? Well, I tell you where we start. I realize what the problem is.
What's that?
Ayn Rand.
Well, yeah.
You know, people, why does that name come up about once a year on this show?
It's because that's the philosophical excuse, the underpinnings, so that people who are just sort of just greedy and selfish can pretend it's a philosophy.
Right. No, yeah. I mean, she is called a philosopher. She's rooted in, well, I don't want to get too deep into
it. Like vampires?
Into Aristotelian philosophy, like the last 2,000 years of philosophy and how to look at reality had never even occurred. I mean, and her novels are awful, absolute awful pieces of crap. I mean, it's great for sophomores to read. Yeah, it's all about me. Yeah, yeah, my genius is being stifled. Yeah, but you're right. It institutionalizes selfishness, and in that sense, it has to overcome essentially the biology of humanity, the genetic coding of us that is cooperative and loving, and get it down to the single individual tough guy.
Well, but that's just one of the ways in which you can sort of describe humans. You know, there's like male and female, and then there's like, you know, authoritarian types, people who like to be ordered around and who are uncomfortable with ambiguity. I mean, isn't that the whole difference between us and them?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Hey, have you been following the World Series, Billy? The Red
Sox? No, I don't do sports, baby.
Yeah, but you should, because we want...
one of your favorite subjects, the Rockies.
Well, I heard you. I'm listening to you.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard that. That's
and
funny.
Right now, it's top of the ninth, and it's been the top of the ninth for a long time with the Red Sox at bat, which means hopefully they're going to get like a 7 or 8 runs or something like that. And
maybe God is on Boston's side.
Yeah.
Well, you know, where that really frosts me is in tragedies like this one, because it's like, well, God spared my house in the fire. God answered my prayers. And what? Did he just screw over your neighbor because he wasn't pious enough? What are you suggesting, honey?
Well, that's the thing. When an airplane goes down and, like 400 people die and a little baby gets saved, it's a miracle. It's God's miracle. Yeah. Well, what about the
Why did God make the airplane go down in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, he knew it. He knew it was going to go down, right?
Why can't he fix an amputee?
I'm telling you. You know, the amazing, you know, I just had to give up my radio show completely because I couldn't find anything positive left to say about the possibility even for this country to save its democracy. It's gone. It ain't coming back. Now, I know, you know, you're making a living and you got to pretend. But it's gone. If we can't do something after the insults of the Bush-Cheney administration and the way they treated us and how they've lied to us and used us and committed fraud upon us and were so unconstitutional, if we have to lie down for that, it's gone.
So you're a weary activist.
I'm an activist. I'm just weary now.
Okay.
Well, here, I was going to pose this. I have this little segment, as you remember, Billy.
It's not that I'm weary. I'm being honest. That's all.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. But we have this little segment. What commie said this, right? Because this sounds so left-wing. It's from a group. Actually, it's a letter to the New York Times today from Bruce Fein, chair of the American Freedom Agenda. And what they're doing is asking all the presidential candidates to sign an American Freedom Pledge. And they're asked to denounce the following powers, if elected, to denounce this: the power to torture, the presidential signing statements. And what you'll see in this is the list of the crimes of this administration. They're asked to give up indefinite detentions of American citizens as enemy combatants, to give up military commissions that combine judge, jury, and prosecutor, to give up spying on American citizens in contravention of federal statutes on the president's say-so alone, kidnapping, imprisoning, and torturing suspected terrorists abroad, give up executive privilege to shield the executive branch from congressional oversight, give up prosecuting journalists under the Espionage Act, give up listing organizations as terrorist group based on secret evidence, suspending the writ of habeas corpus during the conflict with international terrorism, and invoking the state secret privilege to deny victims of congressional wrongdoing from any judicial remedy. Now, Billy, what commie said that? Well, I told you.
Yeah, sure. But no hearings, no nothing. Impeachment is off the table. You know.
Wait, let me finish the thought. Let me tell you who did this. This is an organization of conservatives. The American Freedom Agenda.
You know from the name they are.
Yeah, that this is a conservative group who sees that the erosion, in fact, that's too weak. The attack on our Constitution has been so broad by these, I don't even know what they call it, Bushco, this racket posing as a government, that even they think that they've gone too far. Yeah. All right. I'm going to go. Say hello to your lovely wife.
Love you guys.
I'm going to come out and visit you again one of these days.
Do it. Stop threatening.
All right. Bye, Billy.
Bye. All right. Thank you very much. Some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Brad's in Windsor. Brad, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, Peter?
Doing great.
Good. Peter, I just have a comment about. I have a comment and a question, actually. The fast food industry you were talking about earlier, with the 900 calorie breakfast burrito.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, listen. My opinion and part of that is nobody's forcing anybody to go and buy this breakfast burrito. If they're too lazy to go and cook a decent breakfast before they go to work, then that's their problem. Stop picking on these fast food restaurants.
Well, it's twofold. I mean, one thing, we don't allow, I mean, I have my opinion about them, and I can say that I think that anybody that eats that stuff is really endangering their health. I mean, all the evidence shows that. But on the other hand, there are, product safety considerations. I don't know what kind of work you do, but if you work, for instance, with any number of tools, and I think a lot of the rules are at least or more stringent in Canada and in Ontario, is that on power tools that there's legal requirements that certain safety features are there, right?
Yes.
You can't just say, hey, I'm gonna sell this saw without a guard on it. What the hell? And the people are dumb enough to use it, so they'll lose their fingers.
Well, that's my exactly point. If they're dumb enough to go in there and not create a good breakfast for themselves before they go to work, that's why do you have to? They're there to make a dollar, which is, they're not pointing a gun to anybody's head. Now, I don't eat that food. I don't recommend that food. And I'm not suggesting that anybody goes out there and buys that food.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to do that for themselves, go ahead. If they can't resist that, that's not our problem. If you want to be a healthy individual, then you're going to make sure that you have a decent breakfast in the morning before you go to work.
I hear you, but you know, the other thing is there are social costs because you have a national health program. With all of its flaws, is still the envy of a country that has none, like ours. And the more people eat unhealthily, the more they're going to be clog their arteries and clog the health system.
Are you suggesting that the people haven't got a choice?
But he said, well, no, I agree with you. I mean, no matter how much education we have, I mean, is there somebody out there that doesn't realize if a breakfast burrito is over 900 calories and has 60 grams of fat, that's not the best thing in the world for you?
I agree 100%.
I know, I agree with you.
That's the people's choice, whether they're going to eat it or whether they're not going to eat it.
No, okay.
And if they don't eat it, Peter, they'll go to business.
Well, you're right.
Eventually, there won't be. Now, it's a deal here where I figure, okay, it's temptation, and if people can't resist their temptation, then or they're too lazy to make their own supper or too.
Well, I'm just being critical of it. I'm not saying. Oh, well, where am I? I don't know. Whoa, sorry, got my headphones up there a little too loud. What about crack and heroin? Same thing. People are dumb
exactly.
enough.
To... You're exactly right.
Okay.
If I have somebody offer me crack, it's either yes or it's no.
Yeah.
Do I know the difference? Sure, I do. Am I going to take the temptation and have the crack, and then become a junkie? Because that's what happens when you take the first hit of crack.
Well, yeah, but what I'm getting at though, that's against the law because we think that product is so dangerous to health that we're willing to put people in jail and create this enormous criminal enterprise out of it to save people from addiction. All right, let's see if we can get some other calls on that. I appreciate that. 313-298-WRIF. That what Brad is essentially enunciating, and I have some sympathy for it, is the libertarian point of view. And I don't mean with a big capital L, but a small L, is that we're responsible for packing our own parachute. But on the other hand, think about all the laws that govern other products. I mean, yeah, I mean, what if someone said, hey, I'm making a car without any seatbelt?
Right, exactly. Yeah, brakes. And fast food restaurants make it very easy to eat, to pay for the food. Say someone doesn't have a lot of money or lives in poverty, they can feed a family of four at one of the fast food chains for $10.
Sure.
You know?
Well,
value meals.
You can, no matter how... Usually I was using this about myself, but no matter how you slice and dice it, I mean, Brad is right. There's got to be some individual responsibility.
Right, self-control.
But we know that people don't have it. People don't want to wear their seatbelts. They smoke. I mean, a lot of this is engineered, for things like smoking.
Drive drunk,
yeah. Do I have these? Yeah.
I don't know. You're having headphone issues.
I'm having headphone issues. Let me, we're just screening some calls right now, so hold on and I'll get your calls in just a second. Why is this screening
back? Is that me? Maybe it's me.
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, Stephen in Dearborn Heights wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Bush and Cheney said that the $2.4 trillion war cost is a bunch of nonsense. And wars in Iraq and Afghanistan could cost as much as $2.4 trillion through the next decade, according to news analysis Wednesday. The White House brushed off as, quote, speculation. It's a ton of speculation, says White House Press Secretary Dana Perino. We don't know how much the war is going to cost in the future.
We're glad you have a handle on things there.
Wait a minute. So, first off, they didn't deny this. The bunch of nonsense was Stephen's subject heading on the email. But they're just saying it's speculation. Well, that's scary. So, in other words, it could cost maybe $1 trillion, or it could cost $6 trillion. Right, as we know, right now, Bush has just asked for all these billions more.
Yeah, $196 billion is what he asked for. And he increased the amount by $46 billion over the $150 billion already requested.
Yeah, we keep talking about it going down a rat hole, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, it's going into people's pockets. You have to understand that, people, right? I mean, ain't you and me. It's coming out of our pockets. The reason that Hugo Chavez has to send subsidized oil and contributions to the South Bronx and other places in the United States is because this country is being looted of its wealth by this elite of the military-industrial complex. All right. I want to get some other people on the line, though, about this fast food thing that Brad from Windsor brought up. We were talking about this hearty breakfast burrito that had over 900 calories and 60 grams of fat.
Grams of fat are you supposed to have in a day?
I think maximum of 60.
Okay.
That's it.
I could never eat that much in a day of fat.
Oh, God.
I mean, if I really tried, but I never, ever.
Where did I? Oh, I think. For one thing, it is absolutely disgusting.
What about how much fat is in a steak? I don't know.
But I can't find the article, naturally. But it had, like, what? It had eggs and sausage and ham and bacon.
Right, yeah. Mm. They covered all of the pork products.
They did.
Mm-hmm.
They did. All right, here's Katie in Westland. Katie, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a comment kind of about the fast food thing. I'm a mother of two. I'm 26. And I was raised by a single mother. So I never really had an opportunity, I guess, to learn how to, like, cook and everything.
Uh-huh.
And I work, I'm actually driving home from working 18 hours today.
Oh.
And I work full time. I work, 52 hours in a week.
Man.
I have a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And my husband works full time. So my kind of thing is, I'm not really, I never really was brought up with mom cooking every meal kind of thing, and I work 52 hours in a week, so...
When do you have a chance to cook?
Right. When do I have time to cook? So
right,
I think
exactly.
That's another big thing, that, it's all about convenience.
Yeah, you're busy.
I don't know if there's any particular solution, but that's the thing. It's like... I don't really, my mom, I was a single mama. I was a babysitter at grandma and grandpa's, that type of thing. That's how I grew up.
Well, part of it go ahead.
I don't really have anyone to blame but myself. There is, I know there's better choices out there, but my thing is, I think that's a big thing of, people my age. It's like, how do you even cope with all that?
I think it's difficult. I think it's extraordinarily difficult, and the challenge is a big one, both for your health and sometimes, they say it's fast food and it's cheap, but it really adds up.
Yeah.
One of the things that I know that people that work a lot do and have that kind of busy schedule is they try to cook large meals.
On Sundays.
On Sundays, and I don't know how appetizing this sounds. Like, for instance, the taste buds really react well to the extraordinarily salty, extraordinarily fatty, extraordinarily huge carbohydrate thing.
It's so tasty.
Yeah, so what I'm going to suggest probably doesn't even come near the appeal of a breakfast burrito at Hardee's with its 900 calories and 60 grams of fat, and that is a big, huge pot of oatmeal with fruit in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That you can,
it's cheap.
Yeah.
It's a strange cycle that it's like, you're like, oh man, this is so bad for me, but I got half an hour to get my kids ready and get me to work and mm-hmm. to get where I need to be. And they need to be fed before they get there.
Well, I'll tell you, whole grain cereal and some low-fat milk, with fruit in it. I mean, but see, part of the problem is, and it has to do with all the addictions that come in this society, if kids particularly get used to eating high-fat, high-salt, high-carbohydrate...
Everything else tastes horrible.
Everything else...
That's how I grew up.
Yeah, yeah, well...
That's how I grew up, so I absolutely know...
Well, I'll tell you, it's going to cash in. I mean, we know that this is one of the more unhealthy populations in the industrial world, and it has to do with obesity. It has to do with clogged arteries. It has with a whole host of things that are related to our diet. And I don't mean to lecture you, because probably if you've looked at any women's magazine, if you watch Oprah and all that stuff,
yeah, definitely,
that stuff is talked about all the time.
Yeah,
but it really take some doing. And think about this. Think about a country that says it supports family values, yet necessitates, in order to have a standard of living that you and your husband feel is necessary for the two of you and for your child or children, that you you have to work that intense schedule. I mean, this is and at the same time, you add that over to the hundreds of billions of dollars that are being paid to these huge aerospace and weapons manufacturers to keep this war in Iraq going.
Yeah.
Well, with that bright little, we'll see what we can do. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, oatmeal.
Oatmeal. Yeah. Well, here, the Colorado Jesus freaks have scored two runs in the bottom of the eighth.
The 4-3?
It is 4-3 Red Sox.
And come on.
The Rockies are at bat. They're one run behind. And if they don't score in this inning, maybe I've jinxed it by talking about a no-hitter.
You're not superstitious.
You don't think Jesus or God hears all this?
No. And I know you don't think so either.
No. Let's see. Here is Jeff. Jeff is in Detroit. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
Ah, that's good. I wanted to comment on what the caller was talking about, you know, with the Hardee's Big Burrito and all that. You know, I think it does, like you were bringing out, it basically comes down to what do you think the government's role in protecting us. You know, the government sets speed limits, age limits for drinking, and all kinds of things, you know, in our best interest, so to speak. And you really need to think, are they protecting us or are they just, you know, controlling us in terms of saying you can have this burrito or you can't have this burrito?
Well, it hasn't come to that, although I think, isn't there some couple of cities that have tried to deal with that? Well, for one thing, it's very frequently that it's the poor that suffer the worst on issues of nutrition and health.
I was thinking about that. And the fact that, you know, most, if you look at it like fresh fruits and vegetables,
yeah,
they're one of some of the most expensive things to buy.
Yeah, if you want to eat healthy, it does cost you.
You know, I mean, the lean cuts of meat, the fresh fish, those are very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, and so that you're really boxing people out. You know, you're already poor to begin with.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and you got to think, how can I stretch my dollar where that, for this least amount of money, I can have something that will fill me up.
Well, pardon me, we gotta go to a break right now before we gotta get these spots in before midnight. But when we come back, I want to talk a little more about the cost of food. And
yes.
I actually don't agree with either of you.
Okay, well,
I
have a story to tell.
All right, we'll be right back. Jeff, thanks for joining us. You can join us too. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
This is WRIF.com.
Yeah.
now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. This is our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with me as usual.
Yes.
Our phone number, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Let's see, what did I want to announce? Oh, yeah, David Rovics, singer-songwriter,
troubadour.
Thank you.
Political activist.
Is going to be this coming Saturday, November 3rd. I don't even have the time on here on my... probably, what, 7:30? I'll get this. This is my off of my calendar. If you're looking for stuff to do, either entertainment or political activity, go here. Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, and then you can click on the little calendar, and that gets it to you. Oh, man, I forgot about something. Yeah, if you want to see what a bunch of twistos the conservatives and Republicans are.
Oh,
this
yes.
is truly amazing. There's this little elephant logo. If you go right to my site, it says, "How sick are conservatives?" Very sick. And it's this endless list.
I had to just shut her down. Yeah. I'd read enough.
What kind of twistoids are these Republicans?
Yeah.
There's
some kind of twistoids.
I would say it's 100-1. For every liberal or Democrat that gets caught in some little deal, there's 100 Republicans.
This is what you think?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're
that's just like your theory about the dog poop.
No, and they're not. How come they don't get caught? They're not doing little boys all the time.
Right?
It's just one case of child molestation after the next. I mean, Democrats, you get some of these guys who's like stealing stuff or, you know.
No, they want to go get spanked by the madam in D.C.
This is the Republicans.
No, the Democrats.
No.
Don't they?
No, I don't. Maybe they do. But, I mean, that's all right.
They're just not getting caught.
They're not getting caught. Yeah, like these Republicans with the D.C. madam. I thought
right.
they're talking
okay,
about
right.
Senator Vitter from Louisiana. Another one of these values guys.
Oh, yes. Kind of values.
Oh, this is actually in a couple of weeks. So I'm going to be speaking at the Democracy Fair. It's going to be in Port Huron Township. It's going to be Saturday, November 10th. A number of speakers, and it's going to be a lot of tabling of how you can get involved and stuff. The Democracy Fair, Saturday, November 10th, from 2 to 5 p.m., I'm going to be speaking. Man, this sounds boring. I promise you it won't be about the Constitution. You
know, no.
You're being nice.
Maybe I'll come see you.
Yeah, well, I hope you do. But I'll make it interesting, I promise. You can go to, what is it? Yeah, BlueNovember.org. BlueNovember.org. Or on my website as well. All right, let's go back and get some more calls. Where are we here? Okay. Here's Brian in Fraser. Brian, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. How are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
I just wanted to talk about, you guys were talking about the cost of food and everything, and actually I thought one of the funny things is you said when you were discussing how they covered all the pork products in the Hardee's or the fast food breakfast burrito.
Uh-huh.
And one of the funny things is that as a chef by nature, and I have my bachelor's degree in culinary arts from a school out on the East Coast, and one of the things that's kind of odd about pork is it's actually one of the leanest commercial meats available on the market.
It's the other white meat.
Yeah.
Yes, it's extreme. Pork tenderloin is extremely lean, and pork loin is extremely lean as well. And it's also, I mean, they're not expensive foods, but I think what's been lost more than, you know, I think what's been lost more than anything is the know-how and the ability to produce good food inexpensively that is healthy. Because I know growing up, you know, my mother worked and my dad's an auto worker, and we didn't always get to eat, you know, necessarily the most healthy food because my mom didn't even really know how. And now that, like, I've gone through, you know, training and stuff, it's quite interesting to find out how a lot of the foods that we consider, you know, some of the best and most, you know, most prized foods are really quite easy to make and very inexpensive, but you have to have the technique down.
Well, I was going to say, as we learned from, I think it was Katie, before, you both have to have the time, and then you also have to, you have to have the ability. And some people just don't have the ability. The ability to cook is just being lost. I mean, guys, traditionally didn't cook very much, although my dad did a lot of the cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I think I do 80% of the cooking in our house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, but because of my schedule, I have the time and I enjoy it. But what do you have to do if you're thinking, wait a minute, I'm being poisoned, and actually eating fast foods is an expensive way. Eating out in general is an expensive way to get your calories and nutrition. You've got to go get a cookbook, right?
Yeah, I mean, my mom, since I've come back, you know, from school, and since I've been able to, you know, do things, and she's seen different things that I've been able to create, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the internet that, you know, gives very simple directions on how to make these things, and then once you make them two or three times, then you have these techniques down, and all you have to do is, you know, swap out a couple ingredients, you know. Even like the top level chefs, like, we're not doing anything new. We're just adding our own twist and swapping in a couple ingredients we like to things that have been done time and time before.
I got it. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Sometimes, well, I'll read this message first. Pardon me. This is from Dean, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Dear Peter and Jolene, the real crime is that the animal product industry controls what the government tells the people about health. The truth is that the healthiest diet for humans only contains about 6% animal products, which the body can tolerate. Says he's been a diehard vegan for 7 years, which means no animal products at all.
No dairy.
Yeah, no dairy, nothing. As long as the Beef Council, Pork Council, Dairy Board, Egg Board, etc. drive the government message, people won't know what not to eat. He says, I applaud the oatmeal breakfast with fruit, but I would substitute almond milk or hemp milk. Hemp milk? What the hell is hemp milk?
You know what? No.
How do you, no. For cow's milk. Actually, I didn't want to say it because I never eat. I
don't drink cow's milk.
I know. It actually kind of turns my stomach a little.
Well, it's...
Literally.
Well, we're the only species that drinks the milk of another species.
That's weird.
It's weird.
The dairy police might come arrest me for telling you people don't need cow's milk for calcium. No, I use soy milk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I use soy milk as well. And I do take calcium supplements.
Well, women should.
Yes.
Right? My wife does.
A brittle bones.
Yep. Okay. Let's continue on. Here is Stella. Stella is joining us from Hamtramck. Stella, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
I'm a vegan, mm-hmm. and my dogs are vegans also, and they're very healthy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't like the government telling us what to do and what we can buy.
Right.
I mean, education's one thing, but, you know. And if we had universal health care, I think that they should put a huge tax on all this crap. But, you know, since we don't, why bother?
Tax on what crap?
Oh, fast food, things that are, like, grossly unhealthy.
Well, listen, all of us like something every once in a while that's grossly unhealthy.
Pizza.
Yeah, the macrobiotic movement that is now all of a sudden I'm Michio Kushi, who I think he's still alive and still running it, which essentially in many ways is a traditional Japanese diet, some fish, but very heavy, grain.
It's a lot of raw, isn't it?
No, they don't do raw. They're the other way around. They don't
eat raw. Okay.
Real grain-based and all that. And he said one time, I heard him talking or something, and he said, people ask me, what do I do when I see a piece of chocolate cake? He says, I eat it. You just don't want to have chocolate cake a lot, right? Because eventually the calories and the fats and what have you will start eroding your health.
Well, right. You can make it with Splenda and good things.
Yeah, you can make vegan.
Blah.
But people expect too much from food, you know?
Well,
they eat for entertainment and
emotion.
You know, people eat too much.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, food is a lot more than just sustenance. I mean, people have, particularly in Western society, well, in all societies, the communal meal, the family meal, the extended family meal, the meal with friends as something way beyond what's necessary for just getting you your nutrition, right?
I suppose.
It's convivial.
Why do you say it like that, so I suppose.
Well, I think Indian food is healthy.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you can eat a lot of good things. You don't have to, you know, people just expect too much from food. These commercials brainwash people.
I'm getting hungry just talking about all of this. I went crazy making a dinner for my wife and I. Was it the day before yesterday? And she said, "Why are you making so much?" You know, and I just had. In fact, it was all you'd be pleased. It was all you could, other than a little feta cheese on this roast pepper salad. It was completely vegan. She says. Right.
She's a doubter.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'll tell you, sometimes, I mean, I don't eat meat or poultry. I do eat fish.
Right.
I can't think of her name now. Says, I eat dead fish meat. This woman who I interviewed called it one time. But sometimes I will go, I don't even intend to do it, but I go an entire day with maybe the most I have is feta cheese.
Oh, as far as any kind of dairy?
Yeah.
I mean, me too.
I don't think about it. I mean, our big favorite this time of year, well, it's ending right now, is fake and bacon lettuce and tomato sandwich.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I've kind of, I've been a vegetarian since I was 17 years old.
Yeah.
Been kind of eating a little meat lately.
Oh, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Right.
Needed some meat on my bones. Literally.
Let's see. Do we have any more mail on that? No. All right. Oh, wait a minute. Here, what is this? Let's go. I want to go back to the game, though. Let's see what's happening. Isn't this game over? Hey.
Peter, maybe you were in the wrong business.
Guess what? I think Jesus just left Denver, right? The Rockies were these born-agains. And the Red Sox have swept the Rockies. And I hate to be mean, but good. I mean, the arrogance of these people, you know, making these statements that it's people of character that are these, that know Jesus and all that. I could puke.
Give me a break. I am so full of character, and I'm not even into that.
Yeah. Wow. All right.
Unbelievable, right, Peter?
Yeah, and they're such hypocrites. You know, the Christian right is going right down the drain. They've actually been replacing a number of these far right wing Christian conservatives that are running these mega churches and saying, "Man, you are too much involved in the world and not enough involved in the soul
and what it's supposed to be."
And they've been replacing these kind of Jerry Falwell types.
Mm-hmm.
Right down the line. So this is a final, I think. Yeah, it looks like a final. Condoleezza Rice started her day in Jerusalem the other day with an emotional visit to Jesus' traditional birthplace in the West Bank town of Bethlehem. The daughter and granddaughter of Presbyterian ministers, she lit a candle in the grotto and paused for prayer. You know, am I the only one that doesn't take her sincerity fully?
Seriously? No, I don't.
Here's what she said. Being here at the birthplace of my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, this is the Secretary
she should
of
not
State
be
of
even,
the United
yeah,
States.
She should not be speaking publicly about her religious beliefs and it should not be news.
Right. Being here at the birthplace of my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, has been a very special and moving experience, she said at the Church of the Nativity. It is also, I think, a personal reminder that the Prince of Peace is still with us. This is this warmonger, this war criminal that lied us into the war in Iraq, that's responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans and Iraqis. And she has the nerve to invoke Jesus as the Prince of Peace. By the way, her father, who was a minister, was also a minister at a Birmingham, Alabama church in 1963 when Martin Luther King Jr. were leading the civil rights struggles. The fire hoses were out. The dogs were out. And her father referred to Martin Luther King and the demonstrators as ignorant Negroes. This is Reverend Rice. And at the time of these historic demonstrations were going on in Birmingham that are part of the fabric of American history, Condoleezza Rice was going to tennis lessons.
But of course she was.
Damn.
Yeah.
So that's the final score. Red Sox 4, the Rockies 3. Too bad, guys. Maybe get a different god.
The right-wing religious Rockies.
Yeah, right. Okay. Let's continue on. In fact, here is Al in Royal Oak. Al, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling us.
Hey, all right.
We're doing good.
Yeah, I didn't know the Rockies were right-wing Christian stuff. I'm glad they lost now.
Yeah, me too.
Because I'm not a big Boston fan. You know, New York and Detroit, I like. But what do you think about this John Kitna guy? He's a quarterback of the Lions. Have you heard anything about... He's one of these wackos, too. And it's like I when I watch the games, I'm almost like I don't want him to win. You know, I mean, I want, you know, the Lions to win, but this guy's like a nutcase, you know.
Well, there is this whole thing of fundamentalist Christianity in sports and where these guys pray together. I mean, what does that mean? They're asking Jesus to let them win? What about the other team? I mean,
I know, it's like ridiculous. I mean, I don't care. He can be whatever he wants to be, you know, but does he have to? I think one time he came out in a press conference with, like, a big cross on his baseball hat or something.
Oh, come on. I never saw that.
Kurt Warner is also that.
He got, like, hit hard one time and knocked out, and he came out of it, and he said it was like a miracle from the Lord or some, you know, ridiculous.
When you hear the sign-off on Drew and Mike, they do the thank you, thank you, thank you, and when you hear thank you, Jesus, that's Kurt Warner.
Really?
Yeah, and he is huge right when that goes.
It's totally turning me off towards the team, you know?
Yeah, what is up with that? Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, so you got two teams praying, you know, each side, like a high school football team. And that's really, you know, these coaches are these nutball, you know, Jesus freaks. And they, you know, they enforce this. And then the kids, of course, you know, to get swept up in it. But,
and then somebody's going to lose, and then what is it? Somebody's got the better Jesus?
Well, maybe, you know.
Or their personal Jesus.
He knows when you are, what is the thing?
That's Santa Claus.
Oh, it's Santa Claus, right. but the same thing.
And he's not real.
But if
sorry, kids.
If God is omniscient, he knows all, sees all, and so maybe he knows that although this one kid is praying that really, you know, he's been drinking and boinking his girlfriend. And that's why the team loses. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, with your abilities or anything.
I'm not here to knock Jesus. I don't know what it's like maybe a prophet or whatever. I have no clue, but it's like, you know, it's a personal thing. Keep it to, you know.
I agree. Well, you know what? The Christian conservatives say that they always blame it on liberals. You know, that's the only thing wrong in the world is liberals. Nothing else is wrong, just liberals.
Yeah.
And they say that that liberals want to kick religion out of the public square, to which I think we were saying 2 weeks ago, I said, to which I plead guilty. Let people practice their religions in the houses of worship. And the other thing is, people can pray anytime they want. In fact, let's all pray. Okay, we can pray to whatever. All right, just about, you can't do this a lot on radio. People think we've lost our signal. All right, a nanosecond prayer. Everybody pray.
Okay.
There you go. We all prayed. There you go. Thank you. Thank you, Al. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Chaz in White Lake. Chaz, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hey, how's it going tonight?
Going good.
I'm actually going to kind of mess you up here and take a step back to when you're talking about Condoleezza Rice.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, you made a comment, you know, about her talking about her religious beliefs, you know, wasn't necessarily a good thing. I completely agree with you there. But then you commented on her lying to get us into Iraq.
Right.
And I was speaking from experience here. I just got out of the desert in February.
Yeah.
I've got a little different take on that for you.
What's that? Let's hear it.
Well, you know, they said weapons of mass destruction. Now, you take the general public's idea of a weapon of mass destruction, and they're thinking, you know, mainly nuclear weapons. Well, if you turn around and look at what they found, no, they didn't find nuclear weapons, but they found labs, they found old Soviet warheads.
No, they didn't.
We know Saddam used, you know,
poison gas. Chaz, they didn't find any of that. The United States spent millions of dollars trying to find some evidence that there was some biological, chemical, or nuclear warfare preparations, and they found absolutely none. George Bush, while, you know, guys like you were over there fighting, risking your lives, doing whatever you did, getting killed, getting maimed, that there's these scenes of Bush about 2 or 3 years ago laughing about it all. He said, I looked under my desk. I didn't find any weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, ho, ho. Yeah. So funny.
Ho, ho, ho. They knew. I mean, they were raising this issue of, remember, that was the whole phrase. They said, we don't want to find the smoking gun in the form of a nuclear cloud. That was Condoleezza Rice said that, and Cheney said that. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. It was a total lie. I knew there was no weapons of mass destruction, and if you really read through it a lot, it was easy to find out. They lied.
Okay. Well, we do know he used them on his own people, number one.
Yeah.
So, okay, I want to say we did find some more heads, but I could be wrong.
Well, I hate to say it, but you're absolutely wrong. I mean, Bush said there were nothing found. But still, we were going to bring democracy there. And instead, you are over there. You know the condition of the country now. The country has just been destroyed. There's millions of refugees. There's more people now been killed since the United States invaded than Saddam killed.
Correct. Okay. But then you also got to turn around and look at on the other side. We have done a lot of bad there, but at the same time, we have a lot more supporters there than we did going in. If you look right around where the bases are at, you know, we're getting a lot of support from the surrounding people. We did a lot of work to make that better, to make it that way.
Well, wait a minute. For one thing, it's like destroying the country. And then I think what's happening, like the Sunnis probably finally realized the United States is going to get out of there sooner or later. And we better start getting in on these billions of dollars that are being spent over there by, you know, all of us here, the taxpayers of the United States. And we want to see if we can get the U.S. start building some facilities that will correct some of the awful stuff that's been done here. But the damage that's been done, the destruction, I mean, think about that, about this would happen in the Detroit area and out towards White Lake, where there were continual battles going on, the whole cities destroyed, thousands and thousands of people, you know, Chaz, having to flee to Canada because, you know, out of fear of attack from their neighbors or from, American planes. Nothing that the United States can do there now can make up for what Bush has ordered done.
You're correct. I will give you that. But we might as well make an effort, no?
Well, I think there yeah, there should be an effort to get out to repair the damage, to make sure that all the soldiers that were sent over there get the best medical care instead of some of what we've seen, to start creating peace there to begin with. All right, Jess, thank you very much, and welcome home. I'm glad you came home safely.
Yes.
What happened? I looked at something. Oh, here. Yeah. Here's Steve from Detroit. Steve, hi. It's Peter and Jelaine. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you were not last week. I wanted to talk. Can't remember the gentleman's name, the guy that was talking about pornography.
Robert Jensen, who we said we're going to do a second part, and it will be broadcast tonight at 1 a.m. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I wanted to make some comments. I wish he was in the studio now or on the air, because I disagree a lot with what he had to say. I mean, it's basically really, really deep stuff, but I think on the one hand, there's the evidence of women being treated badly in the places where there's the least pornography in the world, like Afghanistan and the Middle East.
Right.
And if you go to Scandinavia, they're full of pornography, and I'd rather have my daughter go to Scandinavia than the Middle East.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a Latin phrase, which I can't remember, which says that just because it's a fallacy to say something was caused by something because it followed it. And what essentially Robert Jensen, who is following the work of Andrea Dworkin, essentially, was that the nature of pornography is so humiliating and degrading to women. Much of it he accurately describes as such, that leads directly towards violence towards women. The only thing is, and what I think I said on one of the interviews I did with him, that there has been such an expansion of pornography throughout society, but there has not been a corresponding rise in violence towards women. I don't think it's just neutral. I don't think you can say that a lot of the pornography that exists has no effect on men's minds.
Well, what about gay pornography? I mean, gay people watch pornography.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if a man is homosexual and he watches gay pornography, is he going to be more cruel towards other men?
I don't think. Look, that's what I. that's what I didn't like about. I love Bob Jensen. He's mm-hmm. been a friend of this show for a long time, and we've interviewed him any number of occasions. But it was partly the type of pornography that he was talking about. I mean, the idea, and I may have said this on it there too, is that the late comedian Lenny Bruce said that conservatives don't want people watching pornography because they're afraid they will grow up and do the same thing. and Jensen's point, though, is what was once really erotic, really appealing pornography was simply a man and a woman having, let's leave aside the gay thing for a minute, having sexual, any kind of sexual activity, that was, people would go nuts for it. Well, now what happens is you got to do more and more stuff. So it gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And a lot of the stuff has to do with the some pretty repulsive stuff. I did a little research. I actually did. And I actually turned any number of it off. I mean, a lot of it is just the way the descriptions on the website themselves, which are totally disrespectful
yeah.
of women and totally disrespectful of sexuality. And has a lot to do with the humiliation and the domination of women. Oh, and he says it's driven by the fact that you've got to have something new and better and different every time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's pretty deep. Now, I'm a Luddite. I don't have I don't have a computer, so the only pornography I see is sometimes I'll rent a tape and my girlfriend and I will watch it.
Well,
I've never seen any of this. I've just seen, kind of, I guess you'd say regular sexuality on tapes,
It goes pretty far.
Yeah, I would say that there are things that in not even going very deeply into this that are, to me, are so repellent that I couldn't even imagine clicking on the site. I mean, just the description. There's one website, I should give it, that has an alphabetical list of different kinds of sexual activity.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody would have said, Peter, alphabetize your sexual preferences, I mean, I probably could have stopped at C or something like that. These people are into, triple M with the different types and activities and ages and sizes and everything under the sun.
Objects.
Well,
yeah.
I partly agree, but that's just like saying, well, if you take an aspirin for a headache, you're on the path towards drugs, and you're eventually going to be a heroin addict.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how this plays out in male consciousness. I think I'm just not sure. I'm not sure why this would be appealing to men to begin with. Because it seems to me to be the antithesis, the opposite of erotic activity. I mean, I found it really offensive because I don't like anything that subjugates people. Now, people want to play that stuff. They have these domination websites, and it's men dominating women. And these are, paid actors, not that they've, kidnapped somebody or anything
right.
like that. And men want to see it. And then there's others where women are dominating men, and some men and women do that in their sexual activity. Whatever.
Have at it.
But we're talking about stuff that goes way beyond that.
Yeah. And there's some slapping and things like, in the face. I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, which,
ugh.
All right.
God.
Okay, thank you very much. Listen up. We're going to have that on at 1 a.m., the second part of our Robert Jensen interview, which is called Getting Off. I can't remember the subtitle.
No, I can't either.
All right, we're going to take a break. Your calls, please, at 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
WRIF.com.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Angeline Jordan is with me. We're here with you for another half an hour or so. We'll start playing the interviews, including the one with Robert Jensen about pornography at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Adam from Romulus writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, why is it the religious right is constantly screaming about how the Bible is against gays and a woman's right to choose based on, quote, the Bible, and yet pork-filled food go unchallenged? Pork, shellfish, and meat with dairy are all forbidden by the Bible. So what's the deal? You can make money off of people eating forbidden food, but how can you make a buck off of homosexuality? Huh? Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you eat meat, you aren't a vegetarian, and Taco Bell was one of your last sponsors.
Okay.
Okay.
We love our sponsors.
Thank you. Yeah. You can go. You can get bean burritos and stuff.
That's what I eat. I adore the bean burritos at Taco Bell.
Yeah, they have actually some healthy food. There are some of the... Well, you know where is really good is, I can't even think of it. They have, like, veggie patties and stuff. Blimpies.
Oh, yeah.
Blimpies is my favorite.
Even Burger King has a veggie...
Does it?
Patty veggie now? Burger. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And I get it like a Whopper.
Prohibition against shellfish, pork, and meat with dairy are followed by only by Jews, and it's in the Old Testament. So, I don't know. Aren't they connected?
Hmm.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Right. Let's see here. Where are we going with? Oh, he's been waiting a long time. Chris and Flint. Chris, thanks for holding on so long. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, no problem. Hey, you guys, like, first time listener for a long time. But back to the vegan thing.
Yeah.
I heard it's good to eat at least 6 ounces of steak or red beef daily.
What do you mean?
Is
you
that
heard?
Wrong?
What do you mean you heard?
I've heard. I've done it all my life.
Hmm.
Beef is good, right?
Well,
I don't know.
Not to Peter, but
I haven't eaten it in a long time.
I would try to limit that if I were you, just from what my doctor tells me, to once a week at the most.
Well, I don't
once
know.
Once a week.
Yeah.
You know,
okay. And go to more lean types of meat like chicken.
The other thing is, Chris, it's partly, you know, do you have your cholesterol taken? Is it low?
No, I haven't had my cholesterol taken. That's probably a bad thing.
I think you should.
Yeah, if it's one. No, I mean, you know, it's
just
not.
Just check it out.
I mean,
like, I'm thinking a 6 ounce steak, that's kind of small.
That is small.
I prefer an 8 to a 12 ounce.
Well,
but,
everything, you know, things in moderation are okay. So,
right,
I mean,
so daily's not necessarily.
If you take your cholesterol and it's like what you get it taken is 160, well, I guess maybe you're not doing anything too wrong. If it's 220, you go, whoa, maybe I ought to look at what's
step
going
on. Step back and eat a chicken.
Yeah.
I think 190, you want to be below. No, now it's more like 180 or 170 they want you to be
is
below.
It that low?
Mine
oh,
is
man.
118.
118?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, let me tell you this. Mine, you ready for this?
Yeah.
Yep.
260.
Unbelievable. And you eat way better than I. It's genetics.
Then I started saying I got to virtually get all animal products out of my diet, including fish, including dairy products,
right,
and everything. So I virtually became a vegan, which means no animal products whatsoever. Not just meat, but no, you know, not eggs, nothing.
Yeah.
And I got it down to 230. That's
wait,
the best
it
I
went up?
No, no, I went from 260
oh,
to 230.
Oh, 260 to 230. That's it?
Yeah. So,
okay.
So I have to take these statin drugs to keep it below 200.
It's, and anyone who knows you and knows your lifestyle is probably amazed. But it is hereditary. And, you know, I mean, you can't do anything about it. I have high blood pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that slipped out of my life in recent years is a lot of what would you call it? The heavy-duty aerobic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do play handball, but that's not steady. You know, you particularly playing
double.
You start,
you stop.
Start,
anything?
Stop, start, stop, start, stop. And I used to play three times a week. I've been playing once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And Tai Chi, which is good for a lot of what the body would like, is it's like anti-aerobic or something like that.
Yeah, it's more of a zen type
how
of
slow,
exercise.
How slow can you move?
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, I don't know, and I keep telling myself that I'm going to find some...
Wait a minute. You walk every day.
I walk. You know, when I walk with my wife, we don't walk at a very fast pace. In fact, what I've been doing, I've been walking a couple miles with her, and then I'll walk a mile at a quick, brisk pace.
So you're getting some
yeah, yeah.
cardio.
I'm okay. I'm all right.
Come on over. We'll go jogging.
Do you jog?
No.
Oh, God.
Kidding me?
Yeah.
I do, too. All right. I don't think it's good for the lady organs.
Hi, you're on the air. I'm sorry. I don't have your name up on the board. Who's calling, please? This is you.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air. Who's this?
Yeah, it is good. I was just listening to you guys on the way in from Ohio.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
You know what's funny is you guys have touched on a lot of things. So it's kind of, it hits a little point here. I just got back from hunting. We killed a deer. I mean, I do a lot of bow hunting, and I know I have high cholesterol. It's weird you guys touch on that and the vegan thing and things like that. But I'll say this, that I have high cholesterol, and I know for a fact that when I eat deer meat or anything else that I kill, I'll guarantee it's not increasing my cholesterol at all. But I'll just say that I don't know. I do some exercise, and I do a lot of exercise when it comes to hunting and fishing. And I can't believe you cut out fish thinking that's going to cut your cholesterol down.
Well, it contains cholesterol.
Yeah.
I've given that up completely. I eat a lot. Actually, eat a lot of fish.
All right.
What?
You have good cholesterol and bad cholesterol.
Well, yeah.
You have omega-3 fatty acids in fish,
which are good for you.
Yeah, which are good.
Excellent.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you have bad cholesterol, which is your fatty meats and anything you eat fried that's at any given restaurant, right?
There's even fat in a chicken breast.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's fat content.
Yeah, and then above that, you have everything that they put in chicken breasts and anything else you buy in the store.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm a big fan of not buying anything in the store because I kill all my meat and I don't buy anything else. But
are we talking to Ted Nugent here?
No. You're close, but
you kill it and grill it.
I mean, honestly, I deer in the back. I just got done cutting it up, and I'm packing my truck and I'm heading back. But it's funny because I was listening to everything. I thought I'd call on the vegan thing, and you guys just went on a tangent, and it was something that
I'll tell you. The people that eat meat, and as you do, kill it and dress it, and face what it's all about. I have great respect for it. I think if everyone had to do that, you'd probably find about 85% of the people, the population, would be vegetarians, don't you think?
I don't know. I guess if you didn't like the whole lifestyle, I guess you would.
Well, no, the cutting up part.
Yeah.
I mean, the killing part I couldn't handle either, but the cutting up part.
It's just like a butcher or anything else, but, when you do that, what you're going to get. When you open up your little meat, bag of meat in the freezer, you know exactly what you're going to get.
Exactly.
You cut it up yourself, and you throw it in there, so.
You don't have all those hormones.
Yeah, no hormones,
antibiotics.
No, animal growth hormones or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all pure.
That's right. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate all that.
Have you ever tried venison?
I've never had venison. I've never had.
I have.
Yeah, you don't like it?
It's a little gamey.
A little gamey.
A little gamey, but the people who love it, and there you go.
Okay. Here's Jason in Royal Oak. Jason, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Calling about some of the comments earlier about having the government being involved in the food business.
Right.
I was thinking, it has to be on some level because, for example, you want to have an organic standard that actually means something or a list of ingredients that actually accurately describes what's in there,
Sure.
I was just thinking, it's got to be involved on some level.
And meat inspection, of course.
Right.
Yeah, because left to their own ways, we know that the incredible, even with it, incredible unsanitary way in which meat was processed, say, 100 years ago before, I think it was called the Meats Act or something like that, they actually got into these slaughterhouses and started examining what was going on. But, this all started, in fact, I should just tell people real quickly, Jason, if they're just joining us. We were talking about this new burrito, breakfast burrito from Hardee's that had 900 calories and like three different kinds of meats and sausage gravy and all that, 60 grams of fat. And it's sort of the suggestion was, or we were knocking around, what role does government have? I mean, should government say, hey, look, you're going to be poisoning your customers? I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't sound appetizing to me, actually.
No, it doesn't. But then Brad from Windsor, who brought this all up, said, hey, people should make the choice themselves. And I remember, actually, I'm remembering all this a lot better than I usually do. And Katie said, look, she and her husband work over 50 hours a week apiece.
She doesn't have time. She has a half hour to feed her kids.
She doesn't have the skills. That's another thing that's lost.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was like with our grandparents, for a woman to have to work, it was almost disgraceful, particularly for a middle-class family.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
That maybe the woman going into the 30s and the 40s, oftentimes a woman would work while she was single, but as soon as she got married, you know, she was just...
she was cooking.
She was a homemaker.
Yes, a homemaker.
Right. And think about how that has been disparaged, that concept. On the other hand, think how that would... there's a disadvantage to everything, being at home alone for, you know, years and years with just children.
Oh, yeah. I have
some problems.
I don't have any children, but I've seen it happen many times. They go a little bit stir crazy, needing a little adult attention.
And women used to go kind of nuts.
Too.
So,
I can see why. Just spending a couple hours at friends' houses, like, oh, my gosh.
Now we got them out in the workplace working 52 hours a week, just like a man.
Right. Yes.
All right, Jason, thank you. We appreciate it very much. Here's John in St. Clair Shores. John, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi, both of you.
Hi.
How are you tonight?
We're doing good.
Yeah. First of all, I think that burrito from Hardee's, I think it's 920 calories.
Yeah, okay. You're right.
Have you had one?
No. I wouldn't even think of it.
Okay.
I would have a heart attack thinking about it.
Yeah.
I know.
I wouldn't go there. Talking about government control, I think, and that's not the reason I did call, but just to mention it, if the government can't control our own food, what we make here in the United States, they sure aren't controlling anything that's being imported, such as all the garbage that we're getting imported from China.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think you have to look at crops and things like that, too, that are pretty unregulated, and I think it's just it's a lot deeper than just regulating the fast food industry.
Oh, absolutely, but you don't hear anybody in the administration complaining about any of the things that we're getting in from China. I guess they don't want to hurt anybody's feeling.
There you go. Well, the big trading partner. And remember, thanks to George Bush, we owe the Chinese a whole lot of money. In fact, they're financing the war, essentially, since we're borrowing every day from Chinese banks. They're essentially financing the war in Iraq. Isn't that sweet? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. The Rockies just got swept by Boston. The Rockies, this team with character, they've accepted Jesus as their personal Lord and manager. And Doug, listening in Trabuco. I wonder if they say that like that. Trabuco Canyon in California says, baseball players are famous, live in big houses, and pull down millions. The team owners are even better off. These are the people who are praying to Jesus to get more. What nerve, what a farce.
Ah, yes.
He says.
Great point.
Yeah. Here in Waterford is Tony. Tony, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Well, I'm calling to talk about two things, actually. The first is about the whole Iraq thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm still confused about the whole thing. Do you guys know why we're still down there?
Yeah, what? Why we're still there?
Yeah, I heard that we were down there for gas prices, and then I heard that we were down there because of nuclear warheads, you know. Why are we down there still?
It's for oil.
For control of the price of oil.
Yeah.
And also to have military bases and an enormous diplomatic permanent structures in Iraq. I mean, it's imperial control of this area, thousands and thousands of miles away from our home, which necessitates the expenditure of hundreds of billions of dollars that aren't being used for what we need here in the United States, and instead goes to this relatively small sector of the business community, the manufacturing sector, aerospace and munitions and weaponry and all that. In fact, that's part of it, because they're just using up all this ammunition, all these tanks and planes and what have you, is that this new budget contains more money for all of that as well.
Yeah, well, it totally makes sense, and we pretty much gained nothing out of this whole thing. Pretty much all we've done is destroyed and rebuild, and we've killed many, many soldiers down there. And I'm just so very confused about why we're still down there. And anyway, the second topic was about the whole religion thing a little bit ago. I've noticed how massive religion has gotten about how sensitive they are. I can understand about how they can get mad if they see, like, Jesus on a wine bottle or something, but they can't teach it in schools anymore. Like, I heard that there was a kid, I guess, in a lower grade, like kindergarten or something, and they were told to draw something that they love, and this kid drew Jesus, yeah. I guess. I don't know if you guys heard about this.
Never heard about it.
No, and the kid was, or the teacher was told that they had to take it down or she'd get sued or something. But it's
well,
crazy.
Careful with some of those things because, you hear stuff and they're more complicated. I can't imagine that. I mean, I know people that teach in Tennessee, which is heavily religious, and that when this friend of mine has students, he says, write about the person you admire the most, and they often write about Jesus as the person. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jesus.
In terms of where our money's going, preparation for World War III, Bush says that if we don't get the nukes out of the hands of Iran, which doesn't have any nukes and doesn't have really the capacity to do it, there's going to be serious problems. So he's planning for this U.S.-led missile defense system in Europe to counter an emerging threat of attack by Iran. So the United States is going to be spending billions of our tax dollars to build these anti-nuke facilities in Eastern Europe, Eastern and Central Europe, to protect Europe against a nuclear attack by Iran?
Mm.
I mean, does anybody take that seriously?
Stirring up the hornet's nest.
Well, essentially what it's doing, it's about, certainly that, and it's also about, it's an arms race bonanza for the same companies that are looting us currently, and except they just got to keep moving it along to spend more reason or to have more reasons to expend these billions and billions of dollars. Where else did I see we were spending billions? Oh, yeah. You might want to spend our money for this as well. American military officials are carrying out a sweeping $2.5 billion overhaul of Afghanistan's police force.
Oh, I missed this one.
Isn't that what you want to do with our money? I mean, either, you know, you're working or your parents are working or something like that. And a portion of that tax money is going for a $2.5 billion overhaul of Afghanistan's police forces that will include retraining the country's entire 72,000-member force and embedding 2,350 American and European advisors in police stations across the country.
And to that, I say, good luck.
Yeah. Any more? Oh, yeah. You know, Iran is the enemy of the United States, and the Iraq government are our pals, right? Well, it turns out that Iraq has just awarded $1.1 billion in contracts to Iranian and Chinese companies to build a pair of enormous power plants. Remember, we're spending billions of dollars there to create an electrical infrastructure, which the United States has not been able to do the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. Again, billions and billions and billions of dollars. That's all gone for this incredible corruption, not only on the part of the Iraqis, but also on the part of these U.S. companies.
Yeah.
So we're being looted, looted, looted. And they finally figured, well, we do have to have some electricity since the United States invasion destroyed the whole grid. So let's get to some people that can really do it. The Iranians and the Chinese.
Wow.
You know, we have...
It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. We're going to have a little feature called Unbelievable.
Yes, I spoke to our voice guy about that.
That's good.
Yeah.
Here, hi, you're on the air. I'm sorry, I don't see your name or your city. You are on the air, though.
Hello?
Yeah,
hello.
Hi, it's you. Who's this?
Yes, yeah, Marvin.
Marvin,
hi,
where
Marvin.
Are you calling from?
Detroit.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, I got two questions. Number one, who is Condoleezza Rice's better half?
She doesn't have one.
Okay.
She's a single woman.
Okay, I mean, nothing's wrong with that, but I mean...
You better say that with Jalene here.
Because I'm the same.
Okay, but I'm just saying, I mean, you know, Bush has his wife, everybody else has their half. I mean, what is her...
Deal?
I mean, is she hetero or, you know, or whatever?
I don't know. He said, we think, don't we think, let's get the gaydar working here. Don't we think he surrounds himself with gay women like Condoleezza Rice?
Oh, that Karen, what's her name? Karen, his, remember?
Yeah. And also, no, Harriet Meyer.
Another single, lifetime single woman.
Yeah, who Harriet Meyer, and her nickname was Harry.
Yeah. I don't know, Peter.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because here you have this Republican.
Oh, what? I have a theory.
What?
He doesn't want women who may possibly have time taken away from their job, with, you know, messing with children and families and things like that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he chooses single, strong women who don't have kids.
Could be. All right. Thank you very much. Well, that is kind of weird, though, because you have, I mean, the base of the Republican Party is racist and homophobic.
Yeah.
And what have you. And the party, though, so here you have these African Americans that are prominent positioned, everything from the Supreme Court, the Secretary of State, and what have you. And, you know, it seems like half the Republican Party is gay, right?
Well, yeah.
What's up with that?
Or they should be, if I mean, admit it.
Oh, yeah. Here's Benny in Dryden. Benny, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, how you doing?
Good.
You know, little time, but let's see, eat kosher. Probably eating less meat is better.
Okay.
But here's the conundrum. You know, you have monotheism. It's very rigid. And it has, you know, democracy really comes from paganism, basically, actually. They're totally in conflict with each other.
What is what?
Monotheism. And, you know, mono, the belief in one
yeah,
God.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And democracy is, you know, it's paganistic. The religious argument is that, you know, it's a kleptocracy, basically, because there's so much corruption
based
in
on
democracy.
Theft, yeah. Yeah.
You know, you have this almost untiable knot that the human race is in. In compromise, I will say this though. Another twist on it is that Christianity does believe in forgiveness. And I know there's skepticism, but you know, just what you were saying on the radio. Christians forgive you for that, believe it or not, where maybe some other religions may not forgive you. And I'm not going to name them because that would be politically incorrect.
Well, I think it depends on, you know, which Christians you're talking about. Some do, some don't. You know,
right.
Some of them think you've made the bad mistake. You're out of here.
Oh, we're burning in hell,
yeah.
According to a lot of people.
Hell,
yeah.
All right, Ben, actually, I got to go. You're right. You didn't have much time. Let's see. Just though, before we go, Deborah writes in, exercise is a crucial component along with diet to keep blood pressure down. Jolene.
Thank you.
As well as my, that's what she writes.
I know.
As well as monitoring a healthy cholesterol level. My bet is that many fast food eaters are sedentary as well.
Yeah.
It's not the meat and or dairy alone. Well, I know. We're sedentary people and we're rushed, we're crushed, we're swamped.
I do yoga.
Okay. That's it. I'm sorry if you're left holding or on hold.
Please call next week.
Yes, indeed. So, Jolene, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
And stay tuned for Robert Jensen.
Thank you to Al, too.
Oh, yeah. Al, thank you so much. Coming up, more about pornography.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
in God. A fake where the saints There's no sex in your violence. 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 Trust you once my wife. Elmer Fenton, Elmer Fenton. I don't think so. Elmer Fenton.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. It's also a pleasure to bring back someone who we have often had on the Peter Werby Show when we want to talk about drug policy issues. He's Ethan Nadelman. Ethan Nadelman is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance at drugpolicy.org. And he and Peter Andreas, who is an associate professor of political science and international studies at Brown University, have put out a brand new book. It's called Policing the Globe, Policing the Globe, Criminalization and Crime Control in International Relations. We're reaching Ethan Nadelman in New York. Welcome back, Ethan.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me, Peter.
Now, don't take this the wrong way, but the subtitle's a little dry. But this is not a dry book, is it?
Well, you know, it's not a drive. It is an academic book mostly, but it hits a very exciting and interesting question and theme, which is the whole issue of crime and law enforcement in international relations. I mean, people talk about how the world is becoming ever more interdependent, how people and money and ideas and whatever it might be are crossing borders at an ever-escalating pace. And so the question that Peter Andreas and I set out to look at was, what happens when crime crosses borders? How do governments respond to this? How do they deal with it? What does the future look like? I came at this because I was interested in the issue of drugs and drug policy, and he came at this because he was interested in the issue of borders, and together we made a collaboration out of this book.
Well, now... Hi, let me interrupt here just a second. This is not Robert Jensen on pornography, is it? My error... let's go back to it. This is Robert Jensen on the Night Call Show, WRIF. Thank you very much for tuning in. If you listened last week, I announced that we were doing something we had never done before on the Peter Werby Show, and that's inviting a guest back for a second time. We've had jillions of interesting people, historic figures, brilliant authors, people doing analysis of current events and what have you, but there was something about this issue and about this book that just struck a chord in me, and I thought it would strike a chord in you as well. So here's what I asked. We invited last week and interviewed Robert Jensen. He's the author of Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity, and it's about the porn industry, the impact that it has on women, the impact that it has on men. And the thing that I thought we had missed particularly was the idea of the end of masculinity and what Bob Jensen meant by that. So we've invited him back. Bob Jensen teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. He has a number of books he's written, including The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, and Cities of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, which we interviewed Robert Jensen about, and it's a terrific book. Bob, well, you said I could throw it to you to sum up pretty much what we said about pornography. Is it fair to say that this is an anti-pornography book? Is it that simple?
Sure, it is. But it's important to mark that it's anti-pornography from a feminist point of view. For a long time, of course, there have been religious right-wing objections to pornography. And that is not the base from which I work. I work from the feminist insights about male dominance and the way that expresses itself in sexuality, sexual violence, of course, but also through sexualized media. And one of those is pornography. So what I try and do in the book is take, 30 years of feminist insights and research, add to it my own work on the matter, and then ask, where are we with the contemporary porn industry? Because one of the things about the porn industry it's important to recognize
Number one, it's an industry. It's a money-making vehicle. It's not a way that people, you know, artists are trying to understand the mysteries of human sexuality. It's like every other industry in capitalism. It's fueled by a desire to maximize profit. It's also an industry that changes very rapidly in that sense, like many other media industries. And one of the things that's changed is, of course, the delivery systems. So we're living in a much more pornographic, saturated world in that sense. Not only now magazines, books, films, but, of course, DVDs, home video recorders, the internet, mobile devices, all of this has become a vehicle for pornography. And the other thing is the content of pornography has changed dramatically, especially in the last two decades. Much rougher, much more openly cruel and degrading to women, and also much more explicitly racist in many ways. So that's the porn industry as we know it in the world today. And the question is, what can we learn about ourselves from that, which leads to discussions of masculinity.
Sure. And, well, one of the things, I've been thinking a lot about this. I took a trip to visit friends in rural Tennessee since I last talked to you last week. And this book and what you said, I can't begin to tell you the discussions that it engendered, including people in women's studies at a Tennessee university. So, of course, that's the beginning always is discussion and thinking and challenging ideas. Now, if 30 years ago, pornography, I know we're not getting the masculinity, we can always do it a third show, right? That it was dirty. You know, that it was guys, you know, going to smokers and you had to get films or go to these, you know, theaters. And now, as we've said, it's a mass industry. It grosses almost $13 billion, more so than all the professional sports, combined. And as you said, it's saturated. So the impact is what? For one thing, when we look at the content, such as you described, getting rougher and more degrading towards women, it takes on a greater and greater proportion in terms of the impact that it has on all of our consciousness.
Absolutely. One of the things the feminist movement originally focused on was the possibility of a connection between the use of pornography by men, especially the very habitual use of pornography, and levels of sexual assault in the culture. Now, that's a hard thing to quantify, to establish connections. There's lots we can speculate about and even some evidence to give us concerns. But one of the things we're also starting to understand is this is a concern not only for, you know, rape rates, but also satisfaction within everyday relationships. I work with a psychologist, for instance, who's doing research on women's satisfaction within heterosexual relationships. And this may shock you, but guess what? She finds that it's not surprising that when women's male partners are habitually using pornography, women's satisfaction with the intimate relationship goes down. What a surprise that when men sneak off to the den and are using pornography in the way that we know men use pornography for sexual stimulation, that it might affect our everyday intimate relationship. So I think, as we say, a more pornography-saturated culture than ever, exposure of at ever increasingly younger ages to more and more rough and degrading pornography, it's hard to believe it wouldn't have an impact on those kinds of relationships, and I think it clearly does.
Now, we've entered an era of increasing equality of the sexes. I mean, certainly the patriarchy isn't gone. Wages aren't equalized. Although, where did I read? I think in New York City, I think that women make more than men. But there has been a drive that was begun by the feminists in it goes back really far. But the latest and most modern incarnation, it was in the 1960s, and a lot of that has been achieved. Do you think that there is a possibility that this is one of the last purviews of which men can at least fantasize about domination over women? I know it happens. I know women are attacked. I know women are subjugated within marriages and relationships, but it certainly is not the dominant. It's not the dominant cultural message.
Well, I might
or social message. Social.
Yeah,
message.
I think actually, what we see is a continuum. The message that men get about masculinity, I think, the dominant message, is that masculinity is about control and domination, and that leads to aggression and violence. So it's true, everything you say is true, of course. There's been something like a sea change in relationships between the genders in this culture over the last 30 or 40 years. And much of that has been to the good, greater equality in the workplace. Still lots of problems, sexual harassment, sexual violence, including problems that used to be invisible. Take sexual harassment, for instance. 40 years ago, of course, women were being harassed on the job and in schools, but there was no way to name it. There was no legal remedy for it. And so as we become more and more aware of these things, we also start to see problems that were previously not visible. But all that taken, yes, there is improvement. And one of the you know, important books of the 1990s was called Backlash. In other words, as women make advances in education, in employment, there is a backlash where men look to reassert control, and one of them clearly is in the intimate sphere in sexuality. You know, I think there are many things that have led to this dramatic increase in pornography, and I certainly think that's likely one of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, there also are many feminists who are also civil libertarians. Like, I don't think she is any longer, or is she? The chair of the American Civil Liberties Union, Nadine Strossen, who wrote a book called In Defense of Pornography. So, part of it was from a civil libertarian basis. And what I said towards the end of our discussion last week, Robert Jensen, was that, I said quite frankly, I don't want you to be my censor, and I'm sure you wouldn't want me to be yours. Given the mass character of pornography, how could we even begin to think about, regulating it? Or maybe your book, Getting Off, just gets us in a conversation so it's not appealing anymore. Other than that, I don't know what to do. Legal stuff, that scares the hell out of me.
Well, me too. I'm a civil libertarian as well. I do a lot of radical political work, for instance, which often puts me in hot water in all sorts of ways, and I'm very protective of free speech, free press, and freedom of association in this culture. One of the hallmarks of the feminist critique has been to reject the existing obscenity law, which I believe is censorship and I believe is inappropriate and constitutionally unacceptable. But we all know that there are kinds of speech that cause harm. The most obvious parallel is libel law. If you say a false and defamatory thing about me, injures my reputation, I have an avenue through civil law to try and redress that grievance. And the feminist movement did propose a similar structure for dealing with pornography. Now, that doesn't mean it's a simple question. And I, too, am very hesitant about imposing legal solutions that could infringe on basic constitutional values. But that said, that doesn't mean, number one, we can't talk about the effects of this. We can't talk about the industry. And number two, it doesn't mean we can't start to think about crafting new public policy responses. And I think the feminist movement, the ordinance, the civil rights approach that came out of that earlier feminist anti-pornography movement, in fact, does provide the basis for that. It's like most legal or attempts to deal with complex social problems legally, it's not completely adequate, and there are concerns. I share them, but I don't think that should end the discussion about it.
Mm-hmm. The book is Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity. Robert Jensen, my guest on the Peter Werby Show. It's at southendpress.org. There's a link on my site as well, peterwerby.com. I asked also people to email comments and questions for you. And actually, there were no questions, and there wasn't a tremendous amount of email. In fact, I mean, and that's what I anticipated. People usually don't do that. It's not an interactive mode. But as we said before, nobody agreed with you. None of the guys. There wasn't any women that responded. And one person used a word about you, and I think this gets to the subtitle of your book, Pornography and the End of Masculinity. And he said, "Who is this weenie?" So by wanting to get rid of pornography of the type you describe, and I have to say, let me just preface one more thing. I thought, well, what the hell? Here's a good excuse. I'll go look at all this stuff. And I started reading descriptions of these, what you call gonzo, or the industry calls gonzo pornography. And I couldn't even get through those. And I'm thinking, I don't want to see this either. I don't know how you spent, you say in the book, the impact that it had on you. But anyway, so you don't want pornography, and then you're a weenie.
Well, in some ways, maybe I am a weenie, and maybe that's not such a bad thing. That is in a culture in which masculinity, the dominant conception of masculinity, is so tied to as I said before, domination, control, aggression, violence. Maybe being a weenie is a good thing. I think we have to look not just at this conception of masculinity that we see so prevalent in pornography, but across the culture. I mean, think of what we consider a real man in this culture. Where are the ways we can see that? Well, in who we emulate, who we hold up as heroes, the military, professional athletes who inflict pain on other people, business leaders who are vicious in destroying the competition, throwing people out of work to increase profits. Those are our heroes. Well, guess what? This culture, not just in sexuality or sexually explicit media, has a conception of what it means to be a man that I think is literally killing the planet. And so I want to resist that. And for me, this critique of pornography is one route into that, one place to see what is the logical extension of this conception of what it means to be a man taken to the nth degree. And that's why I think pornography is important. I think there are real material questions about pornography, that is, how it affects people's attitudes and behavior. But there's also a kind of ideological window that opens up if we take pornography seriously. And we can see how this culture constructs masculinity and, of course, conversely, femininity. And I think it should worry us. If somebody wants to call me a weenie, that's okay. As we like to say, I've been called worse. You know, I can take it. I can take it like a man. You
know? Well, the overall thrust was, who is this guy to tell me what I can watch? And one person described, not in real graphic terms, that he and his partner looked at pornography, and that was, you know, in their intimate life functioned well for them. That other people said it's none of your business how they use it, and essentially that was it was I guess the thrust of it was that you were entering a private sphere of sexual fantasy and intimate interiors.
Well, if this all stayed in the realm of fantasy, then maybe I wouldn't care. That is, if these kinds of ideas about what it is to be a man in a sexual context, for instance, didn't bleed out into the real world where people are hurt by this, well, then maybe I wouldn't care. But, of course, we know that media and any, in fact, representation of the world affects how we see ourselves and how we see others. That's why, for instance, businesses spend about $400 billion a year to advertise. It's because they know that especially very strong, emotional, image-based advertising affects people's attitudes, and that can affect behavior. So it's not crazy to imagine that men's habitual use of this very cruel and degrading pornography, very misogynistic pornography, might have effects on how men come to view women and sexuality. I mean, that's certainly a plausible argument. So it's not about imposing on people's fantasies in some sort of arbitrary way, nor is it about me censoring or policing people. This book doesn't accuse anybody of anything. It asks people to reflect on how, as a culture, we've gotten to this point and what the ramifications of it are. So, you know, let me condense it to one question.
Sure.
Should we worry that as we speak, there are 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old boys in front of a computer having their sexual imagination shaped by images of women in overtly degrading, cruel, and humiliating positions in a sexual context, and those young men's sexual ideas and, in fact, their physical responses are being conditioned by that use of material? Does that bother you?
Well, it bothers me particularly since reading these descriptions. We're not talking, and again, this is going to play on Sunday. We're recording this. So I don't want to be very descriptive, but we're not talking about spanking, folks. We're talking about some thoroughly, close to torturing things that were like thoroughly offensive. And I, like I said, I was going to go try to check some of this out, and the descriptions made me, it was a kind of thing. You'd be like, sometimes when you hear white racist, you're embarrassed to be white because you're afraid you'll be included in on with this gang, even though they represent a small proportion or percentage of the Euro-American population. Same thing here.
Sure.
I mean, I would hate to think that a woman I knew thought I was attracted to this. Well, the other thing, it goes back to the mass nature of this. Before, you could have any kind of cockamamie fantasy in your head, and there was no way to have it realized, in, at least, you know, an image of it portrayed. And now, it's astounding. I mean, I told you, I was looking at this, the contents of this thing. I mean, like, if someone said to me, what kind of sexual stuff can you think of, Pete? I'd say, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 shows you where I'm. And
yeah.
But, you know, this is like 55 or 65.
Yeah. Well, I think you're identifying a very important aspect of pornography, and let's remember pornography in a capitalist commercial context, right? Because people who are producing this are producing it to sell. Now, certainly there's been male aggression, sexual violence, long before there was industrial mass-marketed pornography. So I think you and I would agree that these problems of male dominance are not, you know, new to the pornographic era. But as you point out, some of the images kind of almost defy imagination. Well, why does that happen? Well, it happens because in a competitive market, the standard pornographic script from the old days, I mean, when you and I were kids, for instance, which was fairly straightforward heterosexual sexual activity, at some point becomes commonplace. And so what do producers in a capitalist economy look for? They look to expand their niche market. And where do you go? Well, where pornographies have gone is to ever more extreme and a kind of rough, degrading kind of content. And I think the result is that pornography actually starts to represent sexual practices that, for the most part, are very rare in people's everyday lives. We're being discreet on the radio, but you're referring to practices that are not necessarily overtly violent in the way we traditionally think of violence,
right,
but are so extreme that they make one uneasy just thinking about them.
And one cannot imagine, in actuality, too many women getting off it. I mean, you quote some women in your book, Getting Off, talking about how they do enjoy it, which there, in fact, may be. But, I was doing this show the other night where some guy called in and said he likes to get tasered. Well, you know, it's a little something for everyone. In fact, there's probably some taser porn, but we're talking, you know, I can't imagine women that I know, of course you could say who knows, but that would find a lot of what you describe as pleasurable or allowable.
Yeah. Now, certainly, as you point out, human, you know, experience, and that includes sexual experience, there's a wide variation. We all know from, you know, just, I think, our individual lives, that there are, you know, sometimes extremely different conceptions among people about what is appropriate and pleasurable sexually. But I think you're also right that many of these practices represented in this very mainstream kind of aspect of the porn industry are nothing that really come out of people's everyday lives. I mean, one of the ways I think we can see that they probably don't is that when there are surveys, as there have been in the past, of sexual behavior of Americans, we don't know how often some of these practices that we see in pornography, such as multiple partners, for instance, and I'm, you know, large numbers of multiple and simultaneous partners, you know, there's no data on how often that happens in everyday life because nobody thought to ask about some of these practices because they are, in fact, pornographic practices. They originate to some degree in the industry. I don't mean nobody tried any of these things before there were porn movies, but the kind of routine depiction of them as sexually satisfying, especially sexually satisfying for women, is really a pornographic reality. It's not from the real world.
Let's do this, and you know, we are not going to do a third show, Bob Jensen. We'll be in the Guinness Book of World Records, which maybe that's something to shoot for. But let's say, and we've got about 4 minutes left, unfortunately. Towards the end of Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity, you say that what you suggest. One thing is stop watching pornography. A friend of mine was outraged, and he said, and he told me about this website that he subscribes to, actually has to pay, where it's all just old-fashioned vanilla sex. That is just pure voyeurism, and women are, you know, highly, in fact, it's an sexual environmental website. So does that mean don't look at any sexually explicit material at all?
Well, I think we have to ask, what are we looking for in our intimate and sexual lives? One way to say it, as I do in the book, is what is sex for? Now, I think I would say without hesitation that the kinds of pornography we've been describing, this extreme and extremely degrading and humiliating porn, is without question outside or should be outside the practices for people who claim to be looking for a more just world. Is there any kind of sexually explicit material that's consistent with social justice? Well, I think that's a much more complex question. Personally, what I look for in my intimate emotional and sexual life is connection to real people and a real communication with another person. And I don't think I know how to do that through pornography. I'm not prepared to say that there's no use of graphic sexually explicit material that isn't potentially consistent with social justice. But I'm skeptical. But that's a decision for people to make. I just am trying to suggest it's an important question. Not just this more extreme porn, but even the way in which in a very media-saturated culture, we've been conditioned to look to media for many of our needs. And maybe we should start looking to each other again.
Well, in terms of masculinity, I asked my wife, I said, do you think I'm masculine? She said, what? Like it was the craziest question. Not that she didn't think I was or wasn't, but she said, what the hell? She says, what does that mean? I said, well, I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I read sort of your or summarized what you'd said. It represented. She says, well, you're sure not like that. And being a radical Democrat with a small D, it means I don't want power over anyone. I want to live in a communal world where there's not a hierarchy, where there's not a patriarchy. And can you answer that in 60 seconds? Then we got to go.
Absolutely. I think this desire for a more egalitarian world in the gender realm is consistent with a desire to end hierarchies around race, to end the hierarchies around wealth and power of all kinds. So people often ask me, how did a lefty like you, Jensen, become anti-pornography? And I say, because I take my politics seriously, not only in the global level, but also at the personal and, in fact, the most intimate level. So I think if we are, in fact, looking for a more egalitarian society without hierarchy, the contemporary porn industry is an obstacle to that kind of society, and we simply have to take that seriously now.
Well, the book is Getting Off Pornography and the End of Masculinity. The author is Robert Jensen. It's available from South End Press. You can go to southendpress.org. There's a link on my site, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. And let's see, Jackson Katz. Oh, I've interviewed him, author of The Macho Paradox. And I interviewed him about that book, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. Says, agree or disagree with his analysis or conclusion, but this brave book challenges men and women to face this crucial and sometimes painful subject with courage and hope. Indeed. Robert Jensen, Bob, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
It's always great to be with you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
WRIF.com.
Plastic eyeballs, spray paint.
choking on the splinters.
On 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Morning. Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, as always. And it's been an increasing pleasure over the last few weeks. I'm sure you've probably taken note of this if you've been a regular listener to the broadcast, that I've been bringing friends to the microphone. And it's a pleasure to have people that you know and to allow them to express themselves about the literature that they've written. Joining me today is an old friend, Pun Plamondon. You may remember that name if you remember back in the day. Pun Plamondon was in the White Panther Party. His life intersected with the anti-war culture of the 1960s, with the MC5, Detroit's seminal rock band. And through a series of circumstances that we'll get into, he wound up on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. The name of his book is, and it's a curious one, but it's what I think is provocative. The whole journey is provocative, beginning from the title and the story itself, Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back, a memoir by Pun Plamondon. Pun, a pleasure seeing you once again.
Thank you, Peter. I'm sure you that the pleasure is mine.
Yeah. Hey, this book, as we were talking before the broadcast, the whole story, essentially your memoir up from the moment you were born up till just the last year or two, is really too much to tell in the 25 minutes we have. But just maybe explain the title, Lost from the Ottawa, to begin with, and then we'll get into the story of the journey back as well. So give us kind of an impression of what the book is all about.
My biological parents were mixed-blood Native Americans, and I was removed from their custody and put up for adoption in in 1945. I was adopted by the Plamondons, which was a Catholic, white, hardworking family up in Traverse City. And so that's where the concept of Lost from the Ottawa. At an early age, at 18 months, I was removed from the custody of my parents, biological parents, and put up for adoption. And after being adopted, I didn't really fit in with the Plamondon family. I didn't fit in with school. I didn't fit in hardly anywhere.
Yeah,
and so that's the loss from the Ottawa part of it.
And you were a kid in trouble a lot.
Oh, yeah, very much. Yeah. I was in reform school when I was from 14 to 15 years old.
Now, when I go up to the Traverse City area and you go north in Traverse City, is that what, Highway 7? Is that what it is? Or going up to Northport?
I believe that's it.
There, I always see this mailbox. It says Plamondon.
Oh, there's a lot of Plamondons up there.
Are there?
Plamondon shoes and several Dr. Plamondons. The Plamondon settled in Lake Leelanau, Michigan. In fact, early records show that the first name of Lake Leelanau was Plamondonville.
Hmm.
They were immigrants from Canada and pretty much settled that area. So there's a lot of them up there.
Now, you had a wild youth that could have been a story of many teens in the late 50s and early 60s, car trips all over the United States, brushes with the law, drug and alcohol and sexual adventures, all that are chronicled and lost from the Ottawa. But when I first met you, you were an anti-war activist, and actually, unless it's something that it shouldn't be told, I don't even remember the exact circumstances of our meeting. Of course, I was working with the so-called underground newspaper, the Fifth Estate, then, and bring us into the 60s. I mean, when you took that sort of personalized individual rebellion and transformed it into a rebellion against the society of the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, I came to Detroit in May of 1967, but prior to that, I had been working as a union organizer, organizing migrant farm workers. And so I had just the beginnings of a political consciousness. The war was becoming more visible, and the effects of the war, of course, the anti-war movement was getting started and gaining momentum. So when I came to Detroit, one of the things that impressed me was that people like yourself and John Sinclair were putting out their own newspapers. I was coming from a small town, Traverse City background, and it never occurred to myself or my friends that young people could take matters, as it were, into their own hands and put out their own newspaper and put out their own magazines and put out their own plays. And I thought you had to have a degree or somebody's permission. And here were, again, people like yourself and Sinclair and then others all around the country. The entire underground press syndicate and the underground press movement was just in eye-opening and very exciting for someone like myself, and for obviously for millions of other young people who were shown that doors could open and you could open them yourself. You didn't have to wait. You could do it now.
Well, it's interesting, too, that phrase, counterculture. I think people today, particularly younger people, may think, you say counterculture, they think of somebody with a guy with long hair and a beard. But it was authentically, if you use the word precisely, it was a counterculture, and it was full. It had its as you said, its own press, movies, theater, what so many rebellious movements did. So you came to Detroit, your eyes were open, and you hooked up with John Sinclair, who was associated first with the Artist Workshop, which had begun in 1964. Actually, we interviewed John and other people from the group who they had just celebrated the 40th anniversary of the founding of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then John also worked closely with the MC5, Detroit Seminole Rock Band, and you got caught up with them as well.
Well, I Sinclair at the time, and Grimshaw and Emil Basila and of course, Lenny Sinclair and several others were living above the offices of the Fifth Estate, as you well remember. And I just thought that was about the coolest place to live in the entire world.
It was.
To have a underground paper with their offices below you, and then the mobilization to end the war in Vietnam on the very corner. And so when I finagled my way into that little commune, I thought I was in the center of the universe and felt like I was right there where the action was. And
Well, it was a correct for that counterculture and for what in many ways typified that era. You were.
Yeah. The best thinking, or some of the best thinking, and organizers and activists of that era were, you know, in those offices and frequenting those offices and coming around and visiting and such.
You just mentioned in passing one of the people that was there was Grimshaw, and of course you referred to the genius poster artist Gary Grimshaw, who did the cover to your memoir Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back by Pun Plamondon, my guest. And Gary, most known for his incredible Grandy Ballroom posters. And for those of you maybe who aren't aware of the Grandy Ballroom, isn't everybody that knows a little about music history have to know about the Grandy Ballroom?
Yeah.
Just let's see. Run out some bands that you remember that you saw live.
Oh, Cream, Jimi Hendrix, MC5,
Big Brother in the Holding, Janis Joplin. Big Brother in the Holding.
Yeah.
Did the Who play there, or did you?
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah. I know the Who played at Cobo because the MC5 opened for them.
Yeah.
At Cobo.
Yeah. So life was wonderful. Was it wonderful for you?
Oh, that was the most exciting time of my life. And I said in the book several times that I thank the Creator that I could remember these things. Like the first demonstration I went to in New York, April 15th, and marched with 400,000 people to end the war. I mean, that many people all moving in one direction with the concept of peace in their heart was just a moving, emotional thing. And to go through the riots in Detroit and see the camaraderie among the poor people, it was never a race riot, and don't ever let them say that it was a race riot. It was poor people striking out against that exploitation. And we got to remember, it's so recent, yet so far away in our memory, that the Detroit Police Department was all white, and that there was this incredible drain on the black community with absentee landlords taking the profits from the black community and taking them to the suburbs. And that had been going on for generations. And the stories about how second-class produce, how once the produce gets too old in the suburban stores, they bring it down and sell it in the ghetto stores. Mm-hmm. Those are all true stories. And so to be part of that rebellion against that exploitation and oppression was a spiritual moment for me, just to see it happen.
Well, the one chapter I read of your book, Lost from the Ottawa, was when, right at the time of the riot, maybe you could relate the story, when you and Emil Bacilla were taking a load of, what did you have, baseball?
Brooms.
Yeah, tell this story.
Well, there used to be the Detroit Free Press used to run a column called Action Line, I think. And if you had a problem with a institution or an organization or a corporation and you were running into red tape, or if you had some good community-based thing that you wanted to do, this Action Line column would help you cut through the red tape and do it. And so this was after the Belle Isle Love-In, and I decided and talked to Sinclair and a few others about it that we should do a neighborhood sweep-in, a clean-in, clean up the neighborhood.
And this is in 1967 now.
And the idea, our neighborhood down by Wayne State was made up primarily of poor whites and blacks and Appalachian poor folks and Chicanos. So it was a real multicultural neighborhood. And I felt that by cleaning up the neighborhood together, we could kind of get to know each other and build community. And so Action Line printed my letter, and they made connections whereby the city of Detroit, the fire department, would hook up some hoses to a fire hydrant, and we could literally wash the streets, and this Department of Sanitation would send two trucks, and they'd park them at various corners in the neighborhood for people to throw their stuff away. And Acme Broom and Brush down on the east side donated 100 brooms, some big old push brooms and regular, like, house brooms. Well, they came in long boxes, cardboard boxes. Well, the riots started, and we never got to do our sweep-in. You told me about it on the morning. Asked me if I heard about what had been going on over at 12th and Claremont. And so me and Amo drive over there in his stereotypical hippie van.
Towards the scene of the riot.
Yeah, 12th and Claremont. And when we get there, we get they had a gauntlet of police cars and cops that you had to drive down through, and some cops saw all those boxes in the back, and they were just as long as rifles would be, and so they pulled us over and tore these brooms out of the truck, threw them all around the street, and then, believe it or not, you could hear some shooting from up the block, and some wine bottles started breaking, and the cops just left us there with these brooms, which they thought were guns, and we cleaned up a few and sped away.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Pun Plamondon, his memoir is Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back. And Pun will be reading from his book and doing book signings March 4th, and it's Friday, March 4th, 7 to 9 p.m. at BookBeat, a fine store in the Lincoln Shopping Center, 10.5 Mile and Greenfield in Oak Park. Now, I asked you just a little while ago how you were relating to these events, and you said these were incredible times, and they were. You remember from the Dickens things, the Dickens book, Tale of Two Cities, was the best of times and was the worst of times, because one of the themes through Lost from the Ottawa, of course, is your drug and alcohol abuse, and, in fact, severe addiction.
Right.
So, and that's what I meant as well. I mean, so you were, here you were with music from the MC5 and the Who, these anti-war demonstrations, this cultural explosion, riots in the city. And when did this...
Well, from probably the first year, maybe 2 years, when I came to Detroit, I actually quit drinking. I started doing other drugs, of course, LSD, and smoking a lot of reefer and doing some speed from time to time, but that wasn't a common habit. But the people that I was hanging out with, they didn't seem to drink and abuse alcohol like my old crew in Traverse City. I mean, I hung out with some real redneck beer-drinking brawlers up north. And these people that I was hanging out now around the Detroit Artist Workshop and Translove Energies and the Fifth Estate and other places, they didn't seem to have that same addiction and that same attraction to rowdiness and alcoholism.
We drank hardly nothing,
yeah.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah. We did other things, though, to stimulate our mental capacities.
I did not inhale, though.
No, right. That would be wrong.
Okay. Go ahead.
So anyway, it wasn't really until I got out of prison behind the CIA bombing trial and the wiretapping and such.
People go, what's this about? But okay, we'll get back to that. Go ahead.
That I really started abusing alcohol again. That was my drug of choice. And that had tremendous ramifications for the White Panther at that time, called the Rainbow People's Party, because I believe I played my role in the collapse, and part of that role was functioning at less than my highest ability and being drunk most of the time, quite frankly.
Well, in your memoir, Lost from the Ottawa, I mean, the description of the effect of alcohol on you is absolutely staggering. I had no idea that it had done that to you. I mean, the depths, particularly towards the last quarter of the book, after like 1975, I believe. But at some point, I want to get back to the CIA case, because everybody's going, wait a minute, what's the CIA bombing? What's that all about? But you became a roadie with Bob Seger.
Yeah, right? Well, that was long after I got out of prison.
Yeah.
And the CIA deal.
Yeah.
And let's go back to that CIA deal.
Okay, let's do that one. In fact, I want to get you to read a little from the book as well. Because this is an incredible court case that had ramifications for Watergate and for Richard Nixon and Nixon's eventual resignation. My guest is Pun Plamondon. He's written a memoir, Lost from the Ottawa, The Story of the Journey Back, and it's self-published. And we'll tell you in a little while where you can get it. It's 415 pages, and I just sped through it. Just absolutely incredible. I'm treading a little water here while Pun is finding the section that we're going to talk about. Anyways, there was we heard that there was a CIA office bombed in Ann Arbor. Was it 1970?
No, it was 1968, October.
Okay.
Someone placed a dynamite bomb at a secret CIA office in Ann Arbor, and they were recruiting graduate students and professors. The CIA was. But nonetheless, it was supposed to have been a secret office, and someone found out where it was and pretty much blew it to hell. A year after the bombing, I was charged with doing the bombing and conspiring with Sinclair and Jack Forrest to commit the bombing.
I'm sure my audience would like me to ask you, did you do it?
Well, we're like many governments. I talked to my lawyer 35 years ago, Buck Davis,
right,
and he says, don't say anything about it. And so he's never rescinded that order, and so I'm under strict orders from Buck Davis. I don't admit or deny it.
Okay.
I mean, I have a vested interest one way or another. If I said I did it, I may have a vested interest, or if I say I didn't do it. And I tried to leave it ambiguous in the book as to whether or not I did it, because if I can play that little outlaw card, I will. And I figure it's not my responsibility socially or civically to do the work that the FBI and the Justice Department is supposed to do.
Okay. We'll leave that part at that.
So anyway, a year after the bombing, I was charged. Now, at that time, Sinclair was in prison doing his famous 9.5 to 10 year sentence for possession of 2 marijuana cigarettes, and the entire effort of the White Panther, or at that time Rainbow People's Party, was directed toward changing the Michigan marijuana laws, getting Sinclair and the other prisoners who were doing similar sentences released. We heard about it on the radio, WABX, as a matter of fact.
The bombing, yeah.
That I had been indicted for this. And with Sinclair in prison and our other economic situations about to collapse, I decided quite quickly that I should not be captured, that I should go underground until we can try to get ourselves organized to attack this fabricated case. The point of the case is not whether or not I did the bombing. The point of the case for me was that I knew the so-called evidence they were using against me was fabricated. I never talked to this guy, David Valor.
Who was the government informant.
He was the informant, and they call it the unindicted co-conspirator. I never talked to him about dynamite. I never talked to him about blowing up any buildings. I never talked to him. He supposedly had called me and complimented me on my choice of targets. I never had that phone call. So I knew, whether or not I blew up the building, I knew that the case they were bringing against me was fabricated, and that was reason enough for me to go underground. I went underground, stayed underground for a year, got a phony passport from Canada through those Quebecois, French-speaking liberators up in Quebec, and traveled to Europe and ultimately to Algiers, where I was going to apply for political asylum. And I was staying with Eldridge Cleaver in a small American exile community in Algiers.
Who was a Black Panther, who was on the lam. Yeah.
Well.
And you were on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
Right. While I was in Algiers, of course, we had somewhat of a plan about my going underground, how we would communicate and such. For instance, about 3 blocks from our house in Ann Arbor is a famous dormitory at the U of M called East Quad. And at that time, East Quad had a whole bank of payphones, the old-fashioned kind of payphones that Superman used to change his clothes
in,
you know.
Yeah.
And so we had it set up that on Thursday night at 7 o'clock, every Thursday at 7 o'clock, someone would be at this particular payphone and they'd be waiting for a call from me. So I could call and let people know I was safe or whatever.
Well, Punpun London, could you read a little bit from Lost from the Ottawa?
Thought I would, yes.
And
one of the things that's interesting about our Supreme Court case is its connection to the Watergate break-in. Let me just read a little bit here. Though I didn't know it at the time, this Supreme Court decision and the Watergate break-in were connected. Years later, it was explained to me. The justices decided the Supreme Court wiretap issue on Friday, the 16th of June. According to court rules, the decision was to be kept secret until it was released by the court, in this case, the following Monday. However, someone at the High Court, I believe Rehnquist or his clerk, notified the White House and informed them the wiretap issue had been lost. This meant that any wiretaps installed by the executive branch or its agents or Nixon's reelection committee would be illegal on Monday the 19th when the ruling was made public. The Watergate burglars were sent into the Democratic National Headquarters to retrieve the electronic listening devices on Saturday, the 18th of June, before the Monday release of the decision made warrantless wiretaps unconstitutional. The rest, as they say, sucks.
Wow. Plummeted from his memoir. You know, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. This is we said this was going to fly through. Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back. Give us just a brief idea how you were in the depth of alcoholism to an extent that I was literally shocked upon reading your memoir. And something life-altering occurred.
Well, through a set of circumstances that are almost mystical, I happened upon a Ottawa elder and a holy man. And I told him that I had some court papers that showed that I was part Ottawa and that my biological parents were both Native Americans. I had been trying for about a year to get sober, and I'd quit for 2 weeks or a month, and then I'd drink again and go just nuts when I drank, had blackouts all the time. And my close friends kept telling me that I needed some sort of a spiritual center in my life. I needed to believe in something other than myself. And this Ottawa holy man explained to me that we Ottawa often believe that what we commonly call God is really a mystery, and that I should believe that there is a great mystery in this universe, and that I'm part of that great mystery. And somehow those words and that concept opened up a spiritual part of me that I had just didn't know existed, and I didn't even know I was looking for it. And so that's the story of the journey back. I finally come back to the Ottawa, am recognized by my tribe, and become a tribal council member and a respected and valuable member of my tribe and the Native community of Michigan.
Well, it's an absolute incredible story. You can hear more. And, of course, this is a book, but you can hear more from Pun Plamondon Friday, March 4th. Friday, March 4th at BookBeat, 7 to 9 p.m., Lincoln Shopping Center in Oak Park, 10.5 Mile and Greenfield. And the book will be available for sale then and signing. But what about my listeners that are anxious to get it and won't be able to? You know, people listen all over the country and all over the world.
They can get it directly from my publisher at www.trafford.com, or they can get it at barnesandnoble.com, and very shortly it'll be on amazon.com and Powell's and all the rest of the electronic booksellers.
And I will have a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Pun Plamondon, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Peter. It's really a joy.
You're listening to WRIF.com.